Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, comedian and storyteller Sandra Bernhard, and new Chicago Humanities Festival Artistic Director Allison Cuddy. And now here's your host, a man who's never ever had a professional massage, Justin Kaufman.
That's true. Getting myself ready for Never Have I Ever tonight, 10 o'clock. Never have I ever had a massage. What do? They rub you? Just doesn't. I just feel like just a lot of fake leather and big hands. Not necessarily my thing. Well, that's coming up tonight, 10 o'clock. Never have I ever. I was thinking about the never have. We haven't played in a while, Pete. And I felt like I had to come up with one, and I remember that I've never, ever had a massage. How about that? Are you surprised? Do you look at me differently?
I have never had one either, so
what?
No. Yeah.
Look at us. Two men's men. We're like, no, no one touches it. No one touches my back.
That's right.
We were raised a certain way. Nobody touches the sides of our backs.
Never had. I don't like people touching me. I don't like my. I had never had a manicure or pedicure.
No, I did that. I've
done one, but
I did that out of. I did it out of necessity. A pedicure when I was going to a vacation. My wife forced me to do it,
mm-hmm.
And I did it. And it was real nice. Real nice feeling. Felt like a celebrity. You know, that's how you feel when you get a pedicure as a man. You just feel like a celebrity. You're like, wow, this must be what George Clooney does. I feel like George Clooney today, right? It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Got a great show lined up coming up in this hour. Right after the news, we're going to talk with Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. What a week. Of course, as we know, we talked about it in the Week in Review, the reload last week. Wow. The sugary drink tax, the temporary hold by a judge. So now the pink slips are out, 300 jobs cut, 600 vacant positions gone, making up for the revenue shortfall of the anticipated revenue from the sugary drink tax. A scathing editorial in the Chicago Tribune blaming President Preckwinkle for this mess. Sheriff Dart getting in the action, sort of tit for tat with the president yesterday. Commissioner Boykin and others at the Cook County Board. It just seems to me right now that there's a little bit of disarray, and it's sunken into name calling. So we'll talk with Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle about what she sees for the short term and long term future of the Cook County budget. That's coming up after the 7:30 news tonight, 8 o'clock. Sandra Bernhard in studio, legend. What a day I had today. Watching old clips of Sandra Bernhard on Letterman, 1985 Late Night with David Letterman. When it was. Sandra Bernhard, the stand-up comic who would come in and mess with Dave, and they just had this great rapport, and it wasn't your regular. If you remember the guests he would have, whether it was Bill Murray or Sandra Bernhard, there was just a off-the-cuff feel where you just don't see that on television anymore. Sandra Bernhard's coming to City Winery for a couple of shows. We're going to talk with her tonight about her great career, also about what she's doing here in Chicago. It's coming up at the big table. 9 o'clock tonight. Allison Cuddy's in the house. Allison Cuddy, a longtime friend of mine who I worked with for years, is just named today as Robert Feeder's column, the artistic director of the Chicago Humanities Festival. I'm very excited to have her in. We'll talk humanities. We'll do a tight 20 on humanities. That's coming up in the 9 o'clock hour tonight. And like I said, we're playing Never Have I Ever. As I mentioned, never have I ever had a massage. And also, as my standby, never have I ever gone golfing. And those are two things that a certain type of gentleman enjoys, right? I mean, a golf and then get a massage. That's just not me. I missed that window. I was not.
And yeah, you've talked about this quite a bit. And, you know, Roger Badish is a big golf. I mean, everybody here is like, they're golf people.
Oh, I told you when I filled in for Cochran the one time, everybody was all jazzed about, I think it was the U.S. Open. I don't know what it was at the time. And everyone was just ready to talk golf, and they're practicing their swings. And they asked me, who's going to win the Open? And I'm like, Yvonne Lendl? I don't know. Golf's really not my thing.
So you have an opportunity to play with some people here. Kevin Powell, I see him.
I know,
he's
a,
he's on
point,
a green every morning.
Yeah, I guess. But at this point, you know, like you don't want to be the guy who like has to be out there with Kevin Powell and Jimmy DeCastro, and they're like, bend your knees, straighten out your elbow. You don't want to be that guy. Like, I'm not getting to the big leagues to have any sort of golf experience with the people that work here at WGN till I do like at least 10 practice runs.
It doesn't
40 holes.
It doesn't matter because I've played golf all my life. And, you know, I started as a looper, you know, at Edgewood Valley Country Club as a kid, you know, so, but still to this day, if we go out just to the Park District up here and at Robert A. Black Park District, I'm flop sweating on the first hole because you're so nervous that you're going to see, like, you're going to whiff or you're going to shank it left because people are watching you. The starter is out there. Oh, man. You never get over that flop sweat.
I don't want that. See, now you're just freaking me out. Like, one time I was going to go up there with my brother, and my brother was going to, because he was a golfer, and he was coming up there to Wisconsin to golf with him. And we got to the house, and he had a couple buddies over, and the mimosas started flowing. They're like, who wants to go? Let's just hang out. I'm like, this was my moment, man.
Yeah, and he lost it.
So maybe sometime this summer. News, weather, and traffic tonight with David Jennings and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman, of course. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We will do the carry out. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out, shall we? Here are today's top stories. A Nevada parole board said that OJ can be paroled in October. Nope, you know what? Kill it right off the bat. Pass, pass, pass. I'm over our morbid fascination with this dude. All right, I get it. He probably killed his wife and he got away with it, but he didn't get convicted. Then he got busted for doing something much less, and somehow Lady Justice threw the book at him for some sort of revenge, and now he's getting out. I'm going to start a new chapter in my life. I don't know about you, and it's going to be an OJ-free chapter. I'm not letting him back in. Right? He can find a job as an accountant somewhere else, but he's not being let back into my pop culture window. Who's with me? Come on, we're going to put it in the back of the closet next to Drew Peterson. Big old pass on this story. Well, you knew this was going to happen mostly because the president has been telling us Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller is not just looking into Russia anymore. He has moved on to Trump business transactions. He can do that as Special Prosecutor. The president has said this is totally unfair. And that's probably true if he means like unfair, like someone would investigate him for other things that he's not supposed to. Like, I don't know, Kenneth Starr, anybody? That dude came in to investigate Whitewater land deals and wrote a 400-page report on cigars and a blue dress. Yeah, so at least unfair has precedent, maybe? Sorry, President? A ruling today said that Chicago may have to pay back a substantial amount of money to people who were given red light cameras in the past couple years, this because of corruption. So what does it mean? This means I should be seeing at least $200, and I'm going to take that money and I'm just going to invest it in running more red lights. Right? Put in the red light running fund. McDonald's is really doubling down on the delivery game. In addition to the items on the menu, Mickey D's is also delivering merchandise like hats and sweats. That's right. I said sweats. Yep, McDonald's will deliver sweats to your house. I mean, come on, really? You're going to deliver a Big Mac, a filet of fish, two large fries, two apple pies, two shamrock shakes, and now the clothes that you will need to wear after eating said order? McDonald's is just asking for late night comedy jokes, right? I mean, today is an easy day if you're a writer on Fallon. Sweatpants, Big Mac, have at it. It's ridiculous. This afternoon, there were mass delays on CTA trains due to switching problems, Lake Street. So pretty much every train was late, which, I don't know, somewhat comforting because it means we can all rage out together as a city. One city, one CTA rage, right? Also, where's the New York Times editorial now, Mr. Mayor? I'm going to watch out. New York Post is going to take some time out in the old Tribune. A new study out says that nearly half of so-called liberals don't even like to be around Trump supporters. It seems that it's enough for them to not even want to be cordial, friendly, or to spend time together, saying that their support of the president is too much to overcome, which is fine. I'm sure the Trump supporters are happy that they don't have to pretend to like tofu or listen to that godforsaken hammered dulcimer. which you don't even take lessons for. Have you ever heard of a self-taught hammered dulcimer player? You sound awful, liberal. You sound awful. In weather, wow, last night, what a night for severe weather. Punishing winds made the rains go sideways. Then, of course, more thunderstorms in the morning and more coming through this weekend. Ugh, great. In sports, the Cubs didn't even play today and they gained a half game on the Brewers. Hard to believe it took less than a week for the Cubs to climb within one game of the top spot in the NL Central. How crazy. And as the Cubs surge, the Brewers slide. They got swept by the Pirates today, a four-game sweep. The Pirates are right back in the hunt as well, right on the heels of the Cubs. So watch for that. But then again, it's the Pirates. So yeah. The Cubs will start back up tomorrow at Wrigley against the Cardinals. The White Sox welcomed Yoan Moncada to the squad last night as he began his White Sox career, not with a bang or a whimper, more like a, oh. He walked. Then he went 0-for as the Sox and Carlos Rodon were blown out. Rodon didn't even go four innings in that game. He gave up five runs in 3 2/3. Not good for the guy who's now the ace. They traded Quintana. You are now the man, and you can't go four innings at home? Hope the Sox didn't make a gross miscalculation on this dude, because he's supposed to be the rock that the pitching staff is building upon. But right now, he's less of a rock than more of the cinder block that they make crappy condos out of. You know that cinder block? All right. Today, agent and former Bull B.J. Armstrong said that the Bulls were in the mix for free agent Derrick Rose. What? I'm in. I'd much rather watch a hobbled D. Rose than any other Bull at this point, right? Come on. You know what would be the worst, though? If Derrick Rose actually signed with the Timberwolves and Coach Thibs and they recreated the magic they had back here in Chicago. I mean, the only worst scenario I can think about would be if, like, if Rose signed with LeBron James or something, you know, and they reign supreme in the East. That's not going to happen, right? Is he behind me? He's right behind me. That story's right behind me. It is. The D. Rose camp said tonight they're close to signing with the Cavaliers. Wow, can you imagine that? D. Rose and LeBron James playing on the same team. Well, that was a short-lived glimmer of hope. Where do I buy my Shane Levine jersey? I'm ready. Better get 15% off. How great must it be to be a Cavs fan right now, right? Who cares if they don't win the title? At least they're trying. The last-minute addition of D. Rose, who's a former MVP, would mean that every MVP for the past few years is either on Golden State or Cleveland. How about that for boring? And finally tonight, it looks like the American Idol reboot is a full go. And guess who? Ryan Seacrest will be coming back to host the show again. At this point, is there anything that Ryan Seacrest can't do? I mean, I'm less interested in this show than the other Seacrest pilots I've heard about, like the shaving with Ryan Seacrest. Also, there's Walking the Dog with Ryan Seacrest. Great show. Or my favorite, Toilet Time with Ryan Seacrest. Hey, don't lie. You'd make that the highest grossing show in television history. Emphasis on the gross. Well, that's the carryout for June 20th, 2017. You ordered the fries, right? It's going to take a second. We're cooking them fresh for you, peeling the potatoes in the back as we speak. What? You can see they're from the bag? They're frozen? Well, at least we're heating them up for you. Perfectionist. All right, coming up after the news, we'll talk with Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. Talking about what she's going to do now that the sugary drink tax is on hold. And it seems like all-out chaos and war at the Cook County Board. Tony Preckwinkle, my guest here on The Download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. David Jennings, how are you, my man?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. It's been a while. It's been a week, I think, since you were in last Friday, right?
Hey, I like to visit.
How you been?
I'm doing okay.
What do you got planned for the weekend? Anything good? You feeling the weekend?
No, because I'm here on Saturdays. So it's like,
so your weekend's like a Wednesday.
What weekend? What's that mean?
you're a guy that, like, on a Tuesday, that's full on. You're at the lake. You're at the lake house, maybe hitting the club.
Oh,
a lot going
on
a Tuesday, right?
I wish. Jeez, you really give me such a big life. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coppin, waiting for Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle to join us tonight. Talk about what's happening at Cook County Cook any board with the budget cuts? An amazing story as these were sort of, you think about the budget cuts at the county, they weren't expected because the sugary drink tax was supposed to go in effect July 1st. And so to have a Merchants Association, the Illinois Merchants Association, come out and oppose that, a judge gets a temporary stay on the tax, it's thrown the budget into somewhat of a little bit of a chaos situation. And pink slips have gone out. Vacated job positions will not be filled. It's not a great situation, as some, including Sheriff Tom Dart, are starting to push back on whether or not they will do the proposed cuts. I mean, because you're talking about, with the sheriff's office, you're talking about sheriffs, you're talking about police officers, you're talking about prison guards. Not a great place to be cutting staff. No, there's nowhere that's great to cut staff. I think that's the point that President Preckwinkle is making. So, while we wait on her to give us a ring so we can talk to her tonight, let's give you a little programming update. Tomorrow on the show, Pete and I are out. Got a night off. In, I know, how about that? Amy Guth will be in, as well as Esmeralda Leon and John Hansen. It's fun to have them in. I always love when they're in. So tomorrow night they will be filling in. We'll be back on Monday. And get this, Monday night at the big table, 1-hour-long conversation with new Sun-Times owner Edwin Eisendrath.
Wow.
Yeah. Be great, right? Talk about the future of the paper. Have a lot around whether or not the paper would survive. And we'll talk a little bit about that. But I'm fascinated in where they see it going. Because in the last 10 years, and maybe a little less, 5 years or so, there has been a movement that newspapers were going to stop delivering door-to-door. And they were going to be online only. They were going to be digital products, right? We heard all this about Michael Farrow and Rapoport at the Sun-Times, and we talked about it with the Tribune. And over time, we've kind of seen this shift, or at least delayed, right? I mean, that's kind of what we're seeing. It's delayed. So we have to, like, I'm interested to see what Eisendrath and the investing team that bought the paper wants to do with it. I mean, are they going to continue to put their resources into the tabloid style paper that you buy and read on the train? Or are we going to start to see serious talk, sort of rubber meets the road, where the product becomes a digital product? I'll speak for myself, and I can only speak for myself, but I don't know if I can tell with certainty the last time I read a newspaper.
Let's face it. They really don't have a choice but to go digital.
Right.
I mean, it's on the Internet of Things is where people get their information most of the time. And unfortunately, far too often, it's not even real material.
Right.
But that's it. The trick is, at least with our, well, I don't know if you're old, that old yet, but when the Internet started, everything was free.
Right.
And the problem has been, okay, how do we get people now to pay for what we put out there from the very beginning, for years, free of charge?
It's absolutely the problem. I mean, I don't know how a newspaper, and newspapers are figuring this out. They're doing with subscriptions, and they've tried paywalls, and they've moved the goalposts, frankly, when it comes to what the end game is. I mean, it went from, we're going to lock it down, and you're going to pay a certain amount of money for this. We're going to let you get 5 free articles. We're going to try to sell subscriptions for the good stuff. ESPN sort of did the lead at that, the insider. But all that stuff just kind of moves. It feels like every 6 months or so, they kind of change their way they go about it. The Sun-Times right now doesn't have any sort of restrictions on their website.
Yeah.
They go with more of the really chintzy, survey before you can read this article.
Yeah, I mean, growing up, and I mean, until very recently, I was a 3-paper guy, you know, a Sun-Times, Tribune, and whatever, you know, a New York Times on Sundays and stuff. And then, you know, I just kind of weaned myself off that because I was using all the my phone and things. But last weekend, I was downstairs, and my phone was upstairs. I'm like, man, I could really use a newspaper. I don't feel like going all the way up to get my phone or iPad. I was like, I really could use a...
They still drop the papers off here at WGN, and they'll be stacked up. And I will, I mean, I don't want to give away our secrets here, but, I mean, you will have a stack still in the plastic rope when I come on the air at 7 o'clock.
I know. I brought them home every night when I was moving.
Yes, the Trib, Sun-Times, Daily Herald, what, the Daily Southtown, the Wall Street Journal. Yeah. Is there anyone I'm missing? And well, we get a lot of physical paper.
Yeah, right.
But unfortunately, as you ride, you know, public transit, the people who used to read newspapers, they got earbuds in their ears.
They're now listening to something.
They're listening to music. They're listening to podcasts. They're watching something. I don't know. Maybe newspapers need to start working with radio stations, having people talking about the stories. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is.
They kind of do that a little bit with DNA Info. I wonder as we see the advent of places like DNA Info or Chicagoist or some of the old or the more digital only productions, that would pave the way in a way almost to serve as gentrifiers.
Yeah.
They're the artists for the Sun-Times to really dip in and decide and determine to go all digital. And there's a way, I don't know the business, and we're going to talk with Mr. Eisendrath about that, about what that means and how you do that and what does it take to go all digital and what do you save when it comes to resources and what do you have to spend when it comes to resources. I don't know. I don't have the answer.
I believe in paying for a good product. As I say that, though, just this, you know, this afternoon coming in on, you know, I was like, ooh, what's this Tracy Swartz story about the latest reality show? And, you know, I click on it, and it's like, you have reached your maximum limit for this. So I'm like, oh, man. So skip. Let's find something else. I'll figure that one out.
For some of those sites, if you clear your browser history...
Oh,
that will reset.
We should do a new segment called Getting Around the Firewall with David Jennings.
Yeah, really?
We'll give you a little theme song.
Yeah, but that would require me to physically be here, you see. Then they'd have to pay me, which could make it a little more interesting.
Yeah. Always.
Never mind.
It's always more interesting when they pay you. Well, we're waiting on Cook County Board President Toni Preckwinkle. She's a good 10 minutes late here, so I'm starting to feel that her people aren't responding either, so they may have seen the lead that I wrote for the piece or something. I'm not sure what's going on. Usually she's pretty prompt, so I'm surprised, but we'll take a break here. Why don't we do that? And hopefully we'll try to track her down here. Pete and I will try to track her down in the next 3 minutes. If not, we'll continue until Sandra Bernhardt at 8 o'clock. Stay with us.
Keep the music up. Keep the music up. Bring it back. You inspired me for a moment. Is the downbeat with Justin Goffman?
There, we can use your voice, David. I like it. You got the pipes for it. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Goffman. We're with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Well, it's getting nasty over at the Cook County Board. Cook County Board Commissioners and now Sheriff Tom Dart have been critical of the cuts and layoffs needed to balance the county budget. This after a judge ruled a temporary halt to the sugary drink tax that was supposed to go into effect July 1st. It didn't. And now Cook County Board President Toni Preckwinkle has asked different county departments to cut their budgets. 300 pink slips went out already. 600 or so vacant positions will be eliminated. And there is promise of more cuts on the way. The Tribune put out a scathing editorial this week, putting the blame on President Preckwinkle's shoulders. Sheriff Dart said his office didn't create this crisis. And Cook County Board member Richard Boykin said this is a manufactured crisis and Preckwinkle is like a drunken sailor with the taxpayer's credit card. Wow. President Preckwinkle has responded by asking for leadership, not name calling, and she joins me tonight on the download. President Preckwinkle, thanks for taking some time out. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Justin, for inviting me.
All right, so let's first talk about this. You know, obviously the layoffs were unexpected. Are we at the end of the layoffs with the 300 that have been announced and the 600 vacated positions eliminated?
No, we're not. I mean, the first thing I always say is, you know, if you want good government, you have to pay for it. And last fall, when we put our budget together, we said we have two choices. We can raise revenue or we can lay off 1,100 people. You have to understand that in our county budget, about 80% is personnel. So when you're in a crunch, in a crisis, you either raise revenue or you eliminate positions. And that's where we find ourselves today. And I think I should remind your listeners that county government has two principal functions. One is the public health system and the other is our criminal justice system, public safety. That's where 87% of our money goes, 87 cents out of every dollar. 46 cents goes to health care and 41 cents goes to public safety. So when we have to make difficult decisions to balance our budget and to reduce our headcount, it comes in those two areas, public health and public safety. Yeah.
You know, for you, as I mentioned in the lead, some commissioners, including Commissioner Boykin, has called this a manufactured crisis, that you're sort of playing political chicken. How do you respond to that, the idea that this is something that some suggest is manufactured?
Well, you know, when we took our budget vote last fall, Commissioner Boykin voted for the budget with the revenue in it, knowing that it was either revenue or layoffs. So I find his present comments disingenuous. You know, when you're in a leadership position, you have to make tough decisions. And we have balanced our budget for the last 7 years. And at the very beginning, in particular, we had to do that with very difficult decisions, including layoffs. And we're back at the same point now as a result of the fact that we don't have the revenue that we anticipated. We instituted the tax on July 1, and the Illinois Retail Merchants Association sued us, I think, on the 29th or something like that to prevent us from implementing the tax. Mm-hmm. They knew it was coming. We enacted it last November. They could have sued at any point in time, and hopefully it would have been adjudicated by July 1, and we would have known much sooner where we were. But they chose to wait until the very last minute, and they got a temporary restraining order. We think we're in for a long court battle, and we'll ultimately be victorious, but it's, I think, a long battle ahead.
You know, are you surprised? I mean, as you said, I mean, it was in the budget. It was there. The Merchants Association waited on this lawsuit. Are you surprised at the judge's ruling, or did you anticipate that there would be some pushback to a tax like this?
Well, we knew that the Illinois Retail Merchants Association was anticipating legal action. We just expected it a lot sooner. And as for the temporary restraining order, I was surprised. We enacted a tax on ammunition about 4 years ago, and we were sued. But the judge in that instance allowed us to continue to collect the tax while the matter was adjudicated, and we anticipated that that would be the case in this instance as well. That is, if we were sued, we would collect the tax and the matter would work its way through the courts.
The Tribune put out an editorial this week, and Kristen McQuarrie was on the show last week as well, just kind of talking about that this is less about pushback on a sugary drink tax and more a pushback on a tax culture, way where we're sort of getting nickel and dimed in this county, and it's been historical here, and it's at a point where people are sort of saying enough's enough. Do you see it that way? Do you see it that people are really taking a stand on this tax to say enough is enough? We can't just keep getting taxed as you know, members of citizens of Cook County.
Well, you know, I think we have to look at what happened over the last several decades. And we haven't, frankly, been disciplined over a very long period of time and both managed our county finances and ask people to pay for what it costs to deliver services. So, for example, we have a lot of legacy debt that we have to pay for. That's an important part of our budget, significant part of our budget. And we have in Cook County twice as much per capita county debt as Los Angeles, which is twice as big as we are.
Right.
And so, you know, I think there have been, over time, some unfortunate decisions that have left us in a very difficult place right now. You know, I think the city's in similar circumstances. The challenges of the city for the last several decades weren't really adequately met. And so then when you get in the position where you have to struggle with the pension crisis and the legacy debt, you're kind of in a box if you're the executive and you don't have a lot of choices. So, you know, I'm sympathetic to people who are concerned about the taxes, and all I would say is that, again, if you want good government, you have to pay for it. Yeah. And secondly, frankly, we haven't paid over time what we should have for the services that are being delivered, and now that's catching up with us.
I mean, when you ran for Cook County Board President, I mean, it was sort of in the wake of former Cook County Board President Todd Strodger's increase on the sales tax, and that was something that was really sort of, you know, it was everybody across the board had something to say about that in a negative way. You were almost able to run on it, saying, "I'm going to do things differently." As you have been in the job for a couple of years now, do you recognize the need for more tax, more revenue? What Cook County Board President Todd Strodger might have been going for as well?
Well, let me just say, you know, I think that there was a general consensus, which resulted, of course, in my victory, that the county wasn't being run very well. And part of it was the sales tax increase, but part of it was the general sense that the county wasn't being run very well. And those are not exactly the same issue, if you know what I'm saying. I mean, if there's confidence that people are doing their very best at the job that they have, I think there's more tolerance for increasing revenue than there is if there's no confidence in the leadership. So, you know, I found myself in a position where I was succeeding somebody who didn't have public confidence. We worked very hard over those first 4 years to restore confidence in Cook County government. And then we found ourselves in a pension crisis. And again, you know, we didn't get in that pension crisis in 4 years. It was something that was coming from decades of not properly funding our pensions. And we tried very hard to get help in Springfield, and we didn't ask for money. We just asked for changes in the rules so that we as employers could pay more. We could ask our employees to pay more. We could ask our employees to serve longer before they were eligible for retirement. It was shared sacrifice, and we couldn't get the state legislature to give us permission to change the rules. And so then we decided since we were accruing additional liability at the rate of $1 million a day, you know, we had $6.5 billion in unfunded liability. We were accruing, just like not paying the interest on your credit cards. You know, it continues, if you don't pay interest or principal, the amount you owe continues to increase. So we said what we're going to do is raise the penny sales tax so that we can pay our pension obligations and be responsible stewards of county government and not pass these incredible obligations on to our children and grandchildren. So the fact that we eliminated the tax and trimmed county government considerably, gave us the opportunity to use an increase in the sales tax to pay our pension obligations. Now, let me just say, county government is much slimmer and trimmer than it was 7 years ago. Our workforce is down more than 10%. We've reduced our indebtedness by 11%. Now, I challenge any other leader to say the same about their workforce. That's surely not true of the city or the state. So as I said, we've worked very hard to be responsive and responsible, and so far that has generated considerable respect and goodwill, and I'm grateful for it.
President Preckwinkle, my last question just is about the layoffs. I mean, are these permanent, or at a certain point do you go, all right, we're not going to get the sugary drink tax, so let's try to figure out a different place to find revenue?
Well, you have to understand that when we looked at the budget, we said, look, we're either going to have to raise revenue or we're going to have to lay people off. And the first obvious way is property taxes, because that generates a considerable amount of money. But all of our commissioners, and there are 17 of them, not one, and I talked to each and every one, was willing to support a property tax increase. The county has not increased its property taxes since the 1960s, more than 20 years. Hmm. The next obvious way is sales taxes, in terms of generating considerable revenue. We just raised the sales tax to meet our pension obligation and to invest more in infrastructure. And there were one or two people, I think, if I remember, maybe two or three at most, that said they would support an increase in the sales tax. And again, there's 17 commissioners, you need 9 votes. And we ended up choosing the sweetened beverage tax, both because it generated sufficient revenue and it had good public health impacts. The World Health Organization had just suggested that governments, both at the national and the local level, ought to be looking towards taxing sweetened beverages as a way to discourage consumption, because consumption leads to obesity and diabetes and tooth decay and heart disease, all kinds of other negative health outcomes, and so we decided that was the revenue source that we would look to. And it had already been enacted in Philadelphia and Berkeley and other places in the country.
Well, I'd love to have you in at some point in the future to talk about that, because that's such an interesting concept, the idea of a tax to lower a health risk and also at the same time fill a revenue hole. I mean, we're seeing almost with the – it's similar to what happened with the bag tax in the city of Chicago, where – yes, it's great to help with the environment, but at some point you start to lose revenue because people actually change their habits. Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle.
Can I end one thing?
Yeah.
Sure. I wouldn't compare it to the bag tax. I think the more reasonable analogy is to compare it to cigarette smoking. In the 1960s, 42% of adults smoked, and we, having discovered at long last that this was very bad for your health, we taxed cigarettes considerably at all levels, national, local. We restricted the places people could smoke, and we ran a public education campaign against smoking. And now only 15% of adults smoke, and I think that's a good health outcome.
Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle joining us tonight to talk about the Cook County Board cuts and the sweetened beverage tax. President Preckwinkle, thanks for taking some time out. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a stand-up comedian, storyteller, actress, singer, and all-around entertainer. Sandra Bernhard has been a mainstay in showbiz, entertaining us for years on stage and screen. It's been a couple years since she's been back in Chicago, but she is at the City Winery tomorrow night with her one-woman show, Sandra Monica Boulevard, Coast to Coast. The show is a hybrid of new materials, songs, and stories. Bernhard is truly one of the greats. And she hosts the show Sandyland on Sirius XM, and she is in studio with me tonight. Sandra Bernhard, thanks for being here. We appreciate it. Nice meeting you.
Nice meeting you. Thank you.
So
it's great to be back in Chicago.
Tell us about the show. I mean, this is a new show for you. I mean, it's something that you've been working on, but you've played it already in New York, L.A., places like that.
Well, I put new shows together every year at Joe's Pub over the holidays because it's sort of my traditional, showcase and launch for new material. And then when I go out on the road, it's usually a hybrid of material I've been doing for, two shows from Joe's Pub because I don't really go out on the road as much as most people. So it's not like I'm doing it, day after day after day and wearing it out. But it's always very fresh and kind of a reflection of, how I'm observing the world at the time. And it's, personal, anecdotal. The music's all woven in. Here in Chicago, I use, great local musicians that comprise the Sandyland Squad band. And I like to think that I keep everybody on their toes, including myself. And it's an evening of glamour, fun, upbeat, and purposefully right now staying away from most things political because I don't think that it's really uplifting or interesting to come to a live show and see somebody talking about what you hear about 24 hours a day. And the news cycle changes so quickly, and the level is so low that I want to reflect something, it's just more indicative of what I enjoy going to see and what I listen to and what I'm about.
Is it hard for you to take politics out of a show like this? I mean, you want to do the stories, the uplifting stories, stay away from things that might be polarizing. But for you, who's been an entertainer, who says it like it is, that's been your MO for decades. Is it hard to say, I'm not going to talk about politics in a stage show?
Well, my work is inherently political. Everything that I do, everything that I reflect and stand for is infused with politics without being didactic about it. So I never feel like I'm ignoring it. It's just I approach it from a different angle than a lot of people who break it down. A Bill Maher, that's what he does, and many other people are really good at writing political jokes. And that's just – I don't really tell jokes. And so just to talk about it and say, well, address the obvious, really. We're in dire straits. It's a very stressful time for people. And we don't really know how it's all going to shake down or resolve. I mean, history will, like history always does, will find its way in and out of, crises. But this is one that, it's particularly concerning for all sentient people everywhere.
You know, for you, how has your show evolved? I think about you've had the off-Broadway shows, and you've had tremendous success doing one-woman shows throughout your career, even making that transition from stand-up to the stage. How has it evolved? What's a Sandra Bernhardt show like in 2017 that might be different than even 10 years ago?
Well, I think I'm more open to whimsy and fun and spontaneity in a way that, you know, I maybe wasn't 10 years ago. I think my work just keeps getting, you know, broader and wider and more, you know, unexpected even for myself. And when I'm in the groove, I feel like I'm taking people places that I want to go to.
Yeah. Do you find yourself pushing limits? You have been a provocateur and a great entertainer for so long that do you have to push yourself into different areas because you've had such success?
I don't think I push myself. I don't ever push myself. I think things just flow naturally. And you know, doing my radio show every day on Sirius XM Sandyland has been a great sort of lab and you know, experimental place for me to develop material without trying. And, yeah. You know, there's something about getting into your groove every day and having a platform that's not pressurized or stressful allows you to evolve as a performer.
And also, I mean, the idea of doing it every day, the discipline of having a job where you have to go in and perform every
right.
single day for
yes.
you as a performer, how has that changed your outlook on the craft?
Well, it's been great. I mean, at first I sort of resisted it and I didn't think I was going to be able to do it. And then the producers that I had at Sirius were like, just trust it and talk about what you're comfortable talking about and don't worry about it. And then like a month in or 2 months in, I was like, oh, now I'm getting the hang of this. And now 2 years into it, I'm really getting the hang of it. And it feels like second nature and my second skin. And I'm really enjoying it.
What's a preparation like for a show like that? For you to come in?
None. I mean, my producers, you know, we have segments we do. Yeah. And then, you know, I curate the music. I'm just being silly. Of course, there's preparation.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, it's really honing, you know, the day-to-day sort of almost, you know, the trivia into something that's compelling and weaving a narrative for the audience where they get to know you. And I think that's the groove that I got into.
You know, for you, you've been so you're so attractive in the way that you tell your stories. You tell a story and it just feels like it's you're at the dinner table with somebody and you're able to tell entertain.
I try.
But I ask the same question about your telling stories. How much preparation goes into crafting those stories, making them right, and how much of them are just the God-given talents of you being able to shoot off the hip?
Well, they're better when I shoot off the hip. And you know, of course, the important elements of them are there because most of them have either happened or I imagined them. So it's just it's listening to your mind and allowing all that information to flow, and then you sort of like poetry, you create all the flourishes
yeah,
around
right.
it.
Sandra Bernhardt's in studio with me tonight. She's of course the comedian, storyteller, actress, singer. Her show Sandra Monica Boulevard Coast to Coast is on stage at the City Winery tomorrow night. Her show Sandyland on XM Sirius every day around noon, right?
Here in Chicago, yeah.
It's 11 to 12, Sirius XM here. Sandra Bernhardt, my guest tonight at the Big Table. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll continue the conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Sandra Bernhardt's my guest in studio tonight. She, of course, the longtime great comedian, storyteller.
The longtime lover of O.J. Simpson. No, I'm just kidding.
Her show, Sandra Monica Boulevard, Coast to Coast at City Winery in the West Loop tomorrow night. She's in town. First time in a couple of years, but you're always in and out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, last time I was here, I was in Skokie at some performing arts center where I completely went off book and improvised the entire show and had such a great time. So if anybody was at that show, whatever they see tomorrow night will not be what I did at Skokie. That's the good news.
How often do you go off book like that? Where you decide?
I can't. It's just it happens. You know, you just really literally have to be like in some sort of altered state, and I don't mean because of, you know, something exterior, but just something, you know, interior mm-hmm. that just allows you to flow.
Today I went down the rabbit hole and I watched a ton of videos of you with Letterman and stand up from the '80s, and I'm interested in how what you do now and the ability to have the confidence to go in front of a large audience in Skokie and say, you know, I'm going to shoot from the hip. I'm going to go improv on this.
Well, I don't think about it. It's not. I mean, it wasn't like I thought, oh, I'm going to improv. You can never think that because you can't. Either you have your show and you know you can fall back on it, or it just all the
just goes.
Everything comes together in the universe and the heavens open and you're channeling something and you don't even know how you're doing it. So until you're on stage, that is not something you think, oh, tonight I'm going to do that.
But the beauty of watching you on late night television or other places is just it was vibrant, electric television.
Thank you. Your
chemistry with Dave Letterman was tremendous, and so many guest spots that you're on the show. But what I want to get at is how, when you were a young comedian, how much did you rely on just your wit, and how much did you have to be in the clubs like other stand-ups in the late 70s and 80s where you were working on material and continuing to work on your craft in front of audiences?
Oh, I was doing it every night, almost every night of the week. When I was, you know, I started performing when I was 19, and as soon as I got my foot in the door, you know, I was out every night, often sitting in clubs like the Improv and other, you know, crazy venues around L.A. Sometimes I'd wait till 1 in the morning before I'd get to go on, and sometimes the people were drunk and there was 10 people left. And you know, but then things got a little more scheduled as the years went on. But those first years were like just staying up, waiting to my spot, no matter what the situation was, going on and being a professional and giving it my all.
There's so many stand-ups from that time that will talk about that time as the glory days of their careers, the early days where they get on, even you know, watching shows that are based on stand-up comedy now. Do you think favorably upon those years as an entertainer? You look back to the days of waiting till 1 o'clock to get on stage and what was happening?
Well, I mean, it wasn't fun at the time. I mean, you know, it wasn't easy being a woman in 1976, 77, on, you know, waiting around kind of by yourself late at night. I mean, I had some great friends, my friend Paul Mooney and my friend Lotus Weinstock, who were like my two angels who discovered me. And, you know, when they were there, I felt safe. But when they weren't there, I mean, it was sort of like I was just sitting and waiting. Then, you know, you get in your car, 1 o'clock, 1:30 in the morning, drive home by yourself. I mean, you know, yeah. It's not something I would wish for somebody I loved. But that was a different time. It was a less threatening time. And, you know, without it, I wouldn't be who I am today, for sure.
I think about, I mean, I would assume that stand-up comedians still have to go through the same things you were talking about, waiting to get on stage and
yeah.
being in unsafe spaces and things, especially women who are in stand-up. You hear about it every, it seems like every other month and something happening in stand-up. Do you think that it's an improved experience for young comedians who were starting out than when you did back in 1976,
well,
1977?
This is very different. First of all, you know, there's so many women who are incredibly successful now in the past 10 years. It's really broken out more than that. And I think that with the advent of social media and people being able to like put their little, you know, shows on YouTube and, you know, whatever, all the other outlets, I think it's definitely made it easier and opened doors quicker. But I mean, without getting up in front of a live audience every night, you can never know if you're going to be successful in the terms of the long game.
Making that transition to entertainment, to television, you know, and having the opportunity to do stand-up on television, to do the late-night talk shows, to end up being on Roseanne and talk and just becoming a star. Talk about that experience. As we talked about the stand-up scene, was that a different kind of process of starting and experimenting, trying things to get into the entertainment industry than any different than what you just talked about with stand-up?
Well, a lot of things happened by chance for me back in the day. You know, I mean, I ended up on the Richard Pryor show because of Paul Mooney, because he was the head writer, and he just put a lot of people he knew, young people, with Pryor, and Pryor loved that. And I just did a lot of crazy things, you know, that were, you know, from the $1.98 beauty contest to, like, all the things of the day. And then when I had my opportunity to audition for the King of Comedy, I mean, you know, that was just a huge long shot, and I just happened to be the person that fit the bill, and that was, of course, a game changer for me. And then after that, I never had, you know, people were always asking, what's your five-year plan? And I never had a five-year. I still don't have a five-year plan. I mean, I guess I'm a little more focused now because I want to accomplish certain things so that I don't have to keep working as hard as I do. But I think that as a natural artist, as somebody who, you know, relies on their spontaneity, you can't really think of it like that. You can do your projects. I mean, I have two scripted projects right now, but they're with producers, but then you have to find writers, and then and you have to go through the whole process. And often they don't pan out. As many of the things I've tried to get done have not worked out. I'm hoping at least one of these two projects see the light of day. But I don't think that I'm just not that kind of person who thought I'm, you know, I'm just going to, you know.
You have a plan. I have a long-term plan.
Well, not just, I'm just not a, I'm not a, I don't know. I'm just not that kind of person.
Yeah.
I like my freewheeling, you know, life.
And it came across on screen, and it always has. And, you know, watching the clips today, I mean, there is a freewheeling spontaneity to it. And I think that's why it works, because it's not, where'd you go on vacation, Sandra? And then, you know, and then you start your joke. There is this repertoire, and even as you move on to stuff with Madonna, you could tell that it's less and less scripted and more off the cuff. Having a career where you're not making a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan, I would assume that there's a lot that's just kind of, you go with it, but I would assume there's a lot of ups and downs. Why we have a lot of celebrities who come on and we talk about just, people don't recognize the amount of rejection that goes into a career in showbiz. As I think of Sandra Bernhardt, I think you're on top of the world. You know, you're a legend in your field, but I would assume, as you just mentioned, just trying to get projects to go is difficult.
Yeah, I mean, also, like, you know, most often now you have to audition for roles in TV shows and films, and often I don't get them. And I'm always like, the only time I usually get something is if somebody wants me in their show. You know, like Two Broke Girls, or, you know, Will and Grace, or, right. You know, the latest thing I did was just a small thing on Broad City, but I ran into the girls at a party and they wrote a little part for me. So,
well, that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
And, for you,
you know,
right?
I feel like I should be, like, on a TV show on a regular basis, but I guess that'll happen or it won't happen. I don't know. I just keep trucking along, and I don't know. It's just like,
you
can't worry about it.
Yeah.
Well, sure, I think about it, but I mean, there's days when it's frustrating, but most days I just go, well, I like my life anyway, and, you know, I'm not suffering, and I still make money, and I'm doing what I want to do, and I still have the respect of my peers, and hopefully the people who have always enjoyed me continue to enjoy me, and that's the only way you can really look at it and be happy in life.
Sandra Bernhardt's my guest tonight at the Big Table. She's got a show, Sandra Monica Boulevard, Coast to Coast. It's songs, stories, new material, which will be on stage at the City Winery in the West Loop over on Randolph Street tomorrow night. She's also got the show Sandyland. She does daily on Sirius XM, 11 o'clock here in Chicago. All right, here's what we'll do. We'll take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. Sandra Bernhardt in studio at the Big Table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio tonight, the great Sandra Bernhardt, who is on stage.
Who's sipping from a very long orange straw, which is very bizarre. It actually has a very chic hot pink stripe in it.
That's how straws is. That's a Chicago straw right there. That's a standard.
What I've decided, I go to so many shows and they keep giving you water bottles. And I keep saying, why do I want to, like, just keep polluting? So I found this chic, recyclable water cup at the gym at my hotel. So I took it up to my room, and I've brought my own water.
It's a smart move. Here in the Tribune Tower, this is an old, old building. And
I know.
And we have
I hear it's going to become a condo building.
But there's a downstairs, there's just a bathroom. There's no water cooler. There's nothing. So I will fill up a jug for the show. I'll put it in there. And halfway through, I'm like, I'm going to get lead. There's going to be lead in this water. This is just old water. I just feel so. I applaud you.
You know, sometimes you have to just go for it.
Go.
You know,
I don't think that is life advice.
A little light
from you.
Brain damage at this point, will it really matter? Seems like everybody. Seems like the president has light brain damage, and nobody seems to be bothered by it.
Yeah. Sandra Bernhardt's my guest. She's going to be at City Winery tomorrow night. Sandra Monica Boulevard, Coast to Coast.
It's a mouthful,
new show.
I know.
Stories, songs,
the
new
show.
Material.
The new show this year that I'll be doing will be called Sandemonium.
Oh, there you go.
I don't know how many more times I can put my name into the title of a show, but I found one more, and then I'm going to have to go back to, like, other kinds of titles.
I was thinking about this today, you know, because you do songs and you do stories, and you have to constantly be at Joe's, I'm assuming, because you have a loyal following that comes out. You have to constantly come up with new material.
Right.
Like, that's the idea. And I think about musicians. If you were a musician, if Sandra Bernhardt was a musician.
I just keep playing the old hits.
Play the hits. Is that,
go your own way, which I heard in some sort of a pharmaceutical ad last night. I guess, was it for plaque psoriasis? I was like, has Fleetwood Mac become that desperate?
Yes.
Why not?
It is an interesting dichotomy that, you know, musicians, people be mad if they don't play Go Your Own
right,
Way.
Right, exactly.
But with you, I mean, they'd be mad if they hear the same joke again.
You know, they never do, though. Actually, I do pull some of my musical numbers out, like Me and Mrs. Jones or, you know, The Last Cappuccino before the 101. I do dust off some of my old pieces because people
– well,
they're not,
those are songs.
Because
they're not
like – I don't tell jokes.
Right.
You know, they're stories that are evergreen and timeless. They're about my life. They're about my childhood. So you really could pull them out at any point and say, well, I just remembered that memory, you know?
Yeah.
Recall that memory.
You know, and I call you a stand-up comedian.
That's
and
okay.
I guess you are, but when did you make the transition out of doing material that was stand-up-like into a more storytelling
Right from the beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, really from the start. I was always offbeat. People were always wondering what I was doing. The audience, other comics, they were always like standing in the back looking at me like they were in a state of shock. and I just kept doing what I wanted to do.
Was that hard? We already talked about the early days of stand-up. But
well, I mean, it was hard in the sense of, like, I didn't really want to be around most of those people.
And there was no other avenue for you to get into.
Had I gone to New York instead of L.A., I probably would have, you know, done the cabaret circuit, mm-hmm. ended up, you know, doing Broadway musicals. But I just didn't feel like going to New York. I thought it was just too far away from my family lived in Arizona at that point. And I just thought, I don't know, California just seemed like an easier. And I think ultimately it was better because there's something about the West, you know. It's more open. It's like less, you know, old ideas, stodgy, you know. It's like it's the new world. The West is always like, you know, latching onto new ideas.
It's funny because of your success mainly, you know, and not only mainly, but just your
mainly
success.
Many other people have stolen my persona.
Sure, but just the idea of being, I always think of you as being a New Yorker.
Yes.
And you know, you talk a lot about L.A., but it's funny because I think of your time with David Letterman, but also your Broadway stuff. And I just always feel like you are almost like we're a born New Yorker.
Everybody has always thought that, and I take that as a high compliment. And I love New York, and I live there now. But there are longings for California, and of course I'm there quite often. But I don't know, there's something – I've done, I think, my best creative thinking in L.A., there's just something about, you know, the nighttime falls and the streets are rolled up. People are going, you know, there's nobody out at night. So you drive around and your mind is just sort of like there's room to think. Although, I mean, I've been creative in New York, too, of course. So,
yeah,
you're creative wherever you are. Either you are or you aren't.
How do you approach creativity for someone
who
lives
approach it?
You don't approach it? Just comes in?
No, I mean,
you're not like a writer who has to sit down and do 9 to 5 writing?
No, it's never been the way I've done it. You know, literally, I will channel ideas and then I will jot them down and then I'll elaborate on them.
What I love about your career as well, as you just mentioned earlier in this interview, the idea of running into the women from Broad City or even the stuff that I saw today with David Letterman, there's a collaborative spirit in the way that being in New York, there just seems to be this idea that community of artists, actors, singers, writers, they help each other out in a way that they are in other projects and they're around each other. And there's a chemistry for a community that you don't find elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Do you feel a part of that community?
On the periphery. There are certain people that I'm very close with, creative people, but they're not usually like in the mainstream. They're, you know, I tend to stay kind of on the outer edges because I like to do my own thing.
Yeah.
People are, you know, once you're in it and you get to know people, not everybody's as, you know, genuine as you hope they would be. But I know some terrific people, and I've gotten to know some amazing people in the business.
You've had a tremendous career where you've been able to saddle both stage and screen. So you've been able to do things on stage in L.A., like you talked to the actual showbiz industry,
mm-hmm.
Hollywood, and you've been able to be a mainstay in Broadway and New York and the scene with your one-woman shows. Do you like the fact that you can dip in and be indigenous in either
world? Yes, I do. I get very restless. I get bored, and I don't like just doing the same thing over and over again. I mean, I love doing my radio show every day. It's an hour a day, and then I go off and I do other things, but I've always been somebody who longs to do something else mm-hmm. constantly, you know, and I like to travel and I like to go places and I love meeting new people, and I love jumping back and forth for different venues in my career, and that's something that's always been inspiring for me.
It suits the industry that you chose as a lifestyle. I mean, it's just because the idea that projects don't last forever, and
right.
you could have a successful run on Roseanne, and that's 2 years of your life.
Yeah.
Or, you know,
yeah.
this idea that people think about, you approach work in a different way. There's a hire, fire, quit mentality that
right.
people who might be listening right now can't fathom. I can't fathom.
No, well, I mean, that's why most people shouldn't be into entertainment, you know, and a lot of people now think they can be, but you don't, you have to have that, you know, sort of electrified personality and somebody who is, you know, able to just morph from one situation to the next. And you've got to have a major constitution. You have to be very strong. You have to be disciplined. And most people just aren't.
I think of you as a trailblazer. You've done so much where you have brought your voice and your unique style to living rooms across America. People who had not seen your type of comedy elsewhere.
Right.
Do you see that? Do you feel like a trailblazer in showbiz? Do you feel like that you have made an impact in that way to the lives of America?
I mean, I don't think of it in a way of, you know, celebratory.
Yeah,
but
right.
yes, of course. I think, you know... And now doing my radio show every day, and I take callers a couple times a week, and a lot of people call in and are, you know, they're very moving, and, you know, it's not something I was ever used to, is having people call and say, oh my God, and you did this, you did that. So that's very nice, and it's nice to hear. And I think that the key is staying involved in life. I mean, like, you know, walking the streets of New York, that's one of the things I love about it, is like, you know, being in the world, you know, going shopping, you know, going to restaurants, you know, coffee shops, hanging out, you know, being a part of the world. Because once you sort of pull yourself out of it and you think of yourself as a celebrity, you'll never be able to tap back into the source.
Is that hard? Is that hard to do? I mean,
no.
When you start living a life as a celebrity?
I don't really live the life of a celebrity.
Or at least living a life.
I mean, people recognize me,
and
people say hello, and some people do a double take, but I think that I've established myself as somebody who, you know, is accessible, and yet at the same time, people don't feel the need to, like, you know, freak out. You
right.
know, I think it's just how you balance your life and how you go through life. And I've chosen to be somebody who, you know, is autonomous and accessible, and at the same time, somebody who, like, knows how to pull themselves out of situations.
Last night, we had Ice Cube on. Ice Cube was in town. He said something about he's attracted to projects where it's almost like startups, where he likes to jump in and try something new that hasn't been done before, and that's something that has pushed and propelled him in his career.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's similar to the aesthetic that we get from you, this idea that you have you continue to do things to push the envelope. Are you attracted to those kind of opportunities, those projects, to do things that are your projects, that are something that hasn't been seen before, even as
well,
I think it's just a
matter of platforms and venues to do what I do and to keep expanding and evolving what I do. But he seems like a businessman. That's not really my thing per se. I can't, you know, design a line of, you know, sneakers and then go off and do, like, you know, fire festival in the Bahamas. You know what
yeah.
I mean? It's like, those things don't interest me. It's like, I just want to do my work and go home. Like, I don't want to, like, have these, you know, these phone conferences and be a part of some sort of mega thing and, like, some new streaming, you know, entity. I'd say all that stuff just...
Produce the movie of your life? Are you going to do that at least? And
well, yeah. No, probably not, you know? I mean, I'm trying to do a show based on my early life in L.A. when I was a manicurist and starting to perform. And that's one of the projects I'm working on right now. Hopefully all these other shows that have made it on the air aren't going to ruin it. But I think that my story is so personal that, you know, and because I was doing something else other than just performing, it has a chance. That's a sidebar. But anyway, I just like doing things, you know, just a little bit under the radar. And I don't really like being swept up into, like, big things because they usually don't pan out.
Hmm. Well, I'll tell you right now, I'll watch your show.
I'm
intrigued by your
I won't even be on that show.
I'll be on it
in some other capacity.
Yeah.
Like I'll be my agent or something, but I won't be obviously me. So as soon as it's like ready to roll, I'll be doing an open casting for Sandy for young Sandy.
Young Sandy. Sandra Bernhardt in studio tonight. Her show, Sandra Monica Boulevard, Coast to Coast, is at the City Winery tomorrow night in the West Loop on Randolph Street. She also hosts the show Sandyland on Sirius XM Daily. Sandra, thanks so much for being
my
guest.
It's so great to be here. And love Chicago. I mean, if I could live anywhere else, it would be Chicago. And maybe I'll live here sometime. Maybe that'll be my next big move.
We'd love to have you.
Great to be here.
I'm telling you, man, I want to go back again. I just told 630 on text. They said, my wife only knows her from Roseanne. I think I'll show her Hudson Hawk. Always loved her. Right? Hudson Hawk. And I would say, because this is now a way of entertaining yourself at night as well. You don't just need the TV. You got the computer there. I would say search YouTube and just look for Sandra Bernhardt and David Letterman. And this was before Letterman went to CBS, and Sandra Bernhardt was a regular. She was sort of the Kristen Wiig, Will Ferrell of, you know, Jimmy Fallon or whatever. And she'd go on Letterman the same time he would have Andy Kaufman and others like that. And they would have these strange, off-the-cuff, improvised performances where Dave was just laughing at her, and she was just yucking it up. And in this way that is so different. Like, you wouldn't, if it was on right now, it probably wouldn't be funny. Meaning, you know, you would be expecting something, you know, because they've tightly wound late night TV.
Mm-hmm.
Where now you got to come on and you have to say, well, I heard you had an interesting thing happen on Tuesday.
Yeah.
And then you essentially have to.
You can see like people like Conan and they look, you can see them look down at their like their little note cards.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, how was your vacation to?
Yeah, and watching her, and she's got that 80s look. She really does. She's tall and she's skinny and she's like got the big hair, and she usually wears the weirdest outfits just to mess with Dave. It's fun. It's fun. And it's something that I miss because there's something raw. And that, like I said in the interview, I always assumed her to be a New Yorker. She's got that brash kind mm-hmm. of New Yorker. Hey, get off it kind of thing. You know, like she's.
Yeah.
And of course, she kind of made her name by being on with Letterman. So I always just assumed she was like almost around the corner from where they were taping.
Yep.
But to hear her say she was in L.A., it tells you a little bit about the entertainment industry that she'd fly back and forth to do those gigs. So, yeah, really great. Sandra Bernhardt, City Winery. She will be there tomorrow night. So always fun to have people that you grew up with at the big table, right? I mean, I grew up – we kind of grew up watching her.
Yeah.
And she was on Roseanne. We didn't even talk about Roseanne. I had some people ask about the reboot of Roseanne and if she'll be on it. And I had seen her be asked that question. She was on the Wendy Williams show last week, and there were some other articles that were – and she doesn't have an answer to it. Her answer is, I haven't talked to Roseanne. I was not a main character on that show. And if they ask me, I'll do it. So I didn't feel like I want.
You're
at a certain point,
you're
like, I'm not going to get the right answer. Yeah. And I feel like maybe that's not the best place to go, you know, with the limited time that we have. That's always the case. You know, when you're doing this job and you try to dig in on someone's story and there's something that you're curious about and you start looking into how they've talked about it in the past and if they essentially dead end that story, you have to make a choice as the interviewer, like, well, I don't want to dead end it on air for everybody.
Yeah,
you know. So anyway, yeah, if you get a chance, go watch.
She looks the same to me. When you see her in person, it's like, yeah, that's her.
Yeah,
so I was waiting out in the lobby. I was like, that's Sandra Bernhardt. That's her. She looks exactly the same.
Where the security called in.
She has a very unique look.
She does.
Indeed.
She does.
She's very angular, very tall.
Right. Angular is a good way to. Security called up, and when she left, they said, who was that? And I said, that was Sandra Bernhardt just now. And they're like, oh. Like they were really concerned. They really wanted to know who that was. I think it was one of the.
Were they worried about guards. Your personal safety?
No, I think a lot of times people. I heard this yesterday with Ice Cube, too. You're saying, like, you know, the people, they recognize someone who's celebrity, and then, you know, they want to know what the they can't necessarily figure it out because, you know, someone just walks in and walks past them, and they're like, how do I know that? So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a celebrity walks in this place, like, you know, somebody of, you know, Ice Cube stature. You know, it's like moths to light, you know, it's like all of a sudden you see like 400 people that you never see before. Like, oh, you work here during the day?
Yeah. Well,
yeah, the sun
help.
Is up. What are you doing out,
yeah,
man?
It doesn't help that Cube was rolling with like 9 people. He had a video crew with him as well. Mm-hmm. So you create this scene to create a scene.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I mean, there's video cameras on this guy. Who's like, that guy? Yeah. What's Ice Cube? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you're right. They were with video cameras.
Yeah,
so
it's not like
they
had a hood over his head.
Discreet.
Yeah, they knew what they were doing. Yeah. They were trying to attract a crowd. And after the interview yesterday, there were some street performers out here. And I guess the story, I just heard this, but that he was out there with his video crew watching the street performers perform, some kids. And Ice Cube was watching. It's like, imagine that if you're like playing your guitar, there must be some kind of way out of here. And Ice Cube is staring at you while you're like, I hope someone puts a dollar in the pot. And then I started thinking, I'm like, did he give him any money? Or did he turn to one of the 9 guys in his entourage and be like, hey, give him some money.
Give him something. Oh, yeah, and I guess looking back on that with his video crew, are you going to be in like, the documentary about in 10 years when the big three, the 3-on-3 basketball league is like huge, you'll be on the 30 for 30 about like back when the big three started.
Right.
When Ice Cube was making the rounds early.
Oh yeah. Like footage. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It could be like I could be the B-roll. There'd be a narration and they just, you know, they show him making the rounds. And that'd be one question there, but like, what's it about basketball?
They won't. They'll probably use your voice and then just show like the meters.
Yeah.
On the, you know. And, you know, they always show the meters.
The meters. I don't know. I didn't see if they were going. Were they getting shots of the meters? Amateurs. They got to get a shot of the meter.
I was watching the 30 for 30 about Mike Francesa and Mad Dog.
Yeah, right.
Francesa.
How was that? Was that good?
It was great. Yeah, it was really good, but it was just fun. So, you know, it was a lot of old radio footage of, you know, two guys in a studio. And if you have any interest in, if you may not even know who these guys are, you know, guys from New York, but
I know who they are. But that
it was just cool to see, you know, two dudes working in a studio together in the, you know, the late 80s.
It was kind of the birth of sports radio. That's what the whole thing's about,
right?
These guys in New York were kind of the beginning of the talking heads kind of sports radio we know and love now.
And they showed like, and then everybody around the country copied them. And then he showed Mike North and Dan Jiggets from The Score. So it was good to see those guys.
Go. All right. Coming up, we're going to talk with Allison Cuddy. Big day for her. She's now the artistic director of the Chicago Humanities Festival. She big article in Feeder today. Allison, a longtime friend and great to be able to have the breaking news this afternoon and get her in studio on the download tonight. So we'll talk with her coming up right after the news. Stay with us. Thanks, David. It's the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. With you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Patty Vasquez, of course. Coming up in the 10 o'clock hour tonight, we're playing Never Have I Ever. It's a great little game. And I got to say, 312-981-7200, we play for prizes. So essentially, you get to admit something that you've never done before, and you could possibly get tickets to the Chicago Blackhawks convention. No? Those are gone? So then a pizza, which is probably better. I'm not at this point, you know, it's going to be crowded. It'll be shoulder to shoulder. A pizza would be good. But we've got a pizza to give away, Never Have I Ever. As I mentioned at the top of the show, never have I ever been golfing. I don't know about that. Never have I ever had a massage. Never have I ever gone scuba diving. So there's some things. And I find the more we do it and the more people text in and call in, the more I realize the things I haven't done in my life. And you start to get a little, I feel like I'm creating a bucket list with everybody in the Download Nation about the things we all need to do together. So that's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour, 312-981-7200. Well, it was announced today that Allison Cuddy will be taking over as artistic director at the Chicago Humanities Festival. Woo! The festival is a year-round program that features great authors and artists and symposiums on stage all around Chicago. Allison was serving as a program director, a role she's been in since 2014. It's a big move for Cuddy, but a natural one. She spent her early years producing and hosting arts programming at public radio, and she's respected citywide for her arts and culture acumen. So what can we expect from the artistic director of one of the biggest arts programs in the city? We'll find out tonight. Allison Cuddy, welcome to The Download. Congratulations.
Thank you, Justin. It's great to be here.
Great to see you, too. We worked together for a long time.
A long time.
And this is a great move for you. But what does it mean to move from a job like program director to artistic director? What does that mean for the commoners that don't understand titles?
The commoners. Well, I mean, it means that I set the creative vision of the organization. So, I mean, obviously there's a lot of people that work there and we do it together, but I'm charged with that and with some other things as well. So there's no hiding now. There's no getting away. If it doesn't go well, I can't slink away and blame it on someone else.
Right,
it's on me.
Just like what Tony Preckwinkle said, you got to be a leader.
Yep.
You got to step up. All right. Yep. So
you got to lead the leaders.
The Chicago Humanities Festival is something that we've had a lot of guests on the program. And, and we've promoted a lot of things. But tell us about the festival. What it does for the city and what you guys are trying to accomplish.
Right. Well, we've been around a long time. This will be our 28th festival this fall. And that was how we started with the fall festival, bringing a lot of people together at one time of the year, usually organized around some theme that we think is of like broad importance, but using the humanities to try and talk about stuff going on in the world. And I think that right now we are in a super polarized environment, and people are more interested in their differences in a negative way. I mean, like, difference is great, but you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. pointing out the ways they're not like each other.
Right.
And there's a lot of fighting, and there's just a lot of, like, back and forth, especially via social media. And some of that's exciting. And, you know, who doesn't like to get into a good, like, you know, comment war every once in a while?
Social media spat, sure.
Yeah. Have I ever done that? Or what is the question?
Never
have I ever gotten into a comments war. I have not.
You haven't?
I feel like I'm missing out. Yeah.
So exhilarating and so depressing at the same time.
Yeah. It's that the highs and lows. So we try to like find the nice balance. We try to like create a space where people can actually talk to each other, even if they don't agree with each other. They can like tackle really complicated topics or really charged ones. Like, we're doing a summit in July. We don't normally program in July, but we're doing this whole big summit on free speech and privilege and thinking about, you know, speech is this really charged issue right now. And it has to do with the way we're talking to each other online. And so I guess we like to think that we encourage civil discourse, and it's important. We have to talk to each other. We can't run the country if we don't talk to each other.
We can't retreat to the corners, like you even you kind of joked about at the beginning, but we can. I mean, this is a time where we talked about it earlier in the show. There's a study that nearly half of liberal or people who consider themselves liberal won't even be in the same room with a Trump supporter. I mean, we're getting to a point where we're siloing off and we're okay with it. And that's where civil discourse comes in.
Right. And I mean, some of that is just like the false, I'm not going to call it false news, but false representation, because people love the division. They love the headlines. You know, like all the news is meta now. It's like the headlines have nothing to do with the story. You're always like finding out about the story from the jokes people are making, not having actually read it, but like the snarky response. And like this fall, we're doing, our whole festival is on belief. Belief in the sense of like religious and spiritual experience and, you know, do you have a belief in a higher power kind of thing, but belief also in the sense of trust in institutions, so the government, the media, science. And, you know, actually people are coming together across those religious differences more than they ever have before. So some of that has to do with people aren't as involved in organized religion, but people are marrying across religious lines. So actually I think that people are connecting to each other in lots of ways, but you wouldn't know
it. We're just hearing the stories of polarization because that's popular.
And that just people like that more. It makes us like, you know, clutch our pearls or wring our hands or whatever.
Do you at the Humanities Festival, when you... when you're programming a festival that, that surrounds civil discourse in a time where there is this polarization, do you have to go out of your way to make sure it's balanced, to have a conversation that, that is going to represent different points of view?
Yeah, well, we don't, our slogan is not fair and balanced. So that, what does that mean? It means whatever your political position, it's not going to disqualify you from being in the festival. But on the other hand, I don't think we have to approach it that way. We try to instead, so for the theme of belief, we try to approach it, make it as diverse and broad a topic as possible. So bring lots of different, like, what are the varieties of religious experience? And dive in from as many perspectives. Like, for the humanities, sure, you think like art, music, poetry, but we do science and tech and business and, you know, so we bring all of that in as well. So you can think about like belief in relationship to how economic markets work. Like, what do we think, what do we believe about the markets, but how do they actually work and what's, what drives that? So I think that's where our kind of balance comes in, like just trying to be as broad and diverse in our approach as possible.
What I've always liked about the festival is that you will more often than not present the material in interview style or more conversational style, as opposed to an old symposium where someone gets behind a lectern and talks for an hour. Why is that? What do you get out of the idea of having an interview on stage where people can kind of watch that interviewing happen?
Well, right. It's like your show in a way, right? That you get to see people thinking together, that so that it's not just someone relaying the work they've done. And we do that. People come and give lectures, but they're shorter. They don't go for a whole hour. But, you know, so you see people like ideas in motion and being contested and challenged and like, well, what about this and all of that. So I think that like it makes it more like a kind of spectator sport, or you feel like you're a part of that conversation. And then we always have, almost always have Q&A, and so people get to engage. But there's lots of different ways we could be engaging people, and that's what I want to think about. I mean, we're thinking about, you know, not everyone can come to a program, and but they're interested in the ideas, and so what are other ways that they can engage with what we're doing? Because definitely there are people who love what we do but don't always get to come out to the live event.
We're talking discourse, engagement, humanities with Allison Cuddy, the new, brand new artistic director of the Chicago Humanities Festival, just announced today. Allison in studio tonight. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk more here on The Download. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Allison Cuddy, the artistic director. Got a nice ring to it. Chicago Humanities Festival in studio, just announced today. She'll be taking over the reins there. All right, so I'm fascinated because I've always known the Chicago Humanities Festival, and I know that it was a fall experience that would be a week long or two, maybe a month, maybe 2 weeks. I forgot what it was. But the idea that it was once a year and you built up to it. And over the last, I seems like recent memory, the festival has turned into a year-round occasion. I'll get something that says, "Hey, this weekend there's going to be some, you know, a symposium on this or that." I mean, what, talk about that change. Talk about the idea of taking it from one set thing that happens in the fall and doing year-round programming.
Right. It was a big change. It's been a big change, and we kind of did it on a pretty tight timeline. So, you know, it was suddenly like, "Yeah, there we are. We're there all year round." And I think the idea was, you know, partly it was just that there's so many more opportunities and not everyone is available in late October through
like
November.
The guests and things like that.
Yeah, the people that we bring. And so there were people we really were excited to do programs with and we thought would be great. Our audience would really love them and we couldn't. So part of it was that let's start trying to do stuff. And we did like a couple one-off programs here and there in the spring. And then we decided to really like go whole hog and try and recreate the festival experience that everybody knew in the fall and do something like that in the spring.
Right.
So we've done two spring festivals now, and then we'll still do like the one-off, like kind of opportunistic programs here and there. But it was a big shift. It was a big shift because, you know, we were building up to one thing and now we're building up to one thing and we're working ahead to do another thing. And so
Do you have to expand the staff to do that? Do you have to think creatively in different ways? I mean, how do you go from only booking and producing a 2-week festival to year-round programming?
I mean, we have really strong programmers. One, we have a great Rena Rinaldi is our program director, and she's just completely plugged into the whole publishing world, and so has a really strong sense of what's coming out and what's going to be great, what people will connect with. And so, you know, having people like that who are just have that kind of really broad understanding of what we could be doing, that helps a lot. You know, the staff is, I think, about the same. We've added some more people.
So you just have to think about it differently. It's almost like a paradigm shift to say, okay, we're building up to this time. That's how we used to do it.
Right.
And now we have to think differently as a, and that's, I guess that's the role of management.
Well, and I mean, you know what it's like. You're always, the job, doing this kind of work, you're always thinking about programs. What could we be doing? Who could you present? And so in some ways, it also was an opportunity to be more creative in a way that feels natural, like not to have to hold off until this particular part of the year, but really do the things that are meaningful. And you know, I think like this past spring, we did a small festival on the theme of stuff. And it was mostly about like, why do we have so much stuff? Like, and all our weird and complicated relationships to it. But it was a great time to do stuff on, you know, we were talking about like, environmental issues, and there's just stuff in the news going on, you know, and like the haves and have nots, and people were really thinking about like the kind of widening gap between us, between the poor and the rich. And so it was a perfect opportunity to have that conversation, and why wait to have that like 6 months later?
It's amazing to me, because I guess the question I was having is, what is the appetite like for a Chicagoan to come to an event like this? You know, we talked about discourse and we talked about engagement, but I mean, at a certain point, they're used to experiencing that in festival style, where it's like a festival of discourse, right? We're gonna, this is a great week for me.
Right.
Do you have to change the appetite, the habits, the way that people sort of interact with the Chicago Humanities Festival when you expand to a year-round program?
I mean, in some ways, yeah. In other ways, it just means that more people get to interact with us who might not have known about us, right? I mean, there's a lot going on in the fall, and so to be able to be present, and not just at different times of the year, but in different parts of the city, because, you know, we're an itinerant organization. We don't have our own venue, so we rely on the kindness of others. You know, we have partnerships with the Art Institute, the Museum of Contemporary Art, the DeSable Museum, and so thinking about where we are in the city, too. So I don't know if we have to, I mean, I guess to some extent, for people who've been with the festival a long time, to sort of think about, well, now I can go at other times of the year, but yeah, I think it's a benefit, right? And then for other people, it's a way for them to discover us and actually have the experience that they weren't able to have before.
We're talking humanities on the show. Allison Cuddy here. It is interesting, because this, I feel like you've seen a tremendous explosion of humanities and festivals around. I think it's Chicago Ideas Week.
Yeah.
I think that the city does more and more. It seems like every, even the I think of the for-profit sector and Deloitte and others that do like business symposiums.
Oh,
it seems
yeah.
like the idea of a festival symposium or just this idea of discourse is one that is catching on all over the place. I mean, it's out like wildfire in the way that it's like this, and authors are coming in and people are coming in. Do you feel that? Do you feel like there's some sort of change in the way that what people want?
It feels great. I mean, it feels like people really want to get together in a room and experience something and like feel, even if they're not talking to each other. I think that does happen. People come for the ideas and like, you know, the education in a way, but they come to be entertained and they come to like hang out with each other. They want to be with other people who are like them, who are interested in like hearing about this. And that's, you know, a lot of people, but it does feel like that. I mean, there's so many different live events going on, and I do wonder, like, is it again what we were talking about earlier, that actually people do want to be with each other, do want to connect, and this is a way for them to do that in
outside
a way
of
that
social media, right?
Yeah. And then also it's like the media, I mean, right, the whole long form is back again. Look at your show. I mean, you have this long expanse of time to talk about issues, and people settle in, and I think people are looking for that again. They're bored with sound bites. They want to understand more. They're not necessarily going to get it from the usual media outlets. I mean, so they're looking for that kind of substance. So whether they're turning to online platforms that offer them like really long stories, or, you know, longer programs like this, or our programs, you know, so they get to sit with like one or two people for an hour and really hear them think.
I always think about, you know, arts and culture. And at some point, and if you could stick around past the news, we can talk more about this. But the, I am always amazed at the fact that this city continues to strive and thrive as a bastion for arts and culture. That it's not something that goes away, even if government funding gets cut, or even if the ticket prices and rents go high. There's a way that the city comes together and tries to continue the long legacy of arts and culture. Do you feel like you're part of that? Do you feel like with the Humanities Festival that you get this opportunity to express yourself and sort of plug into that, current?
Yeah. I mean, the festival, we bring a lot of people to Chicago, but the festival is also a platform for so many people here who are doing really interesting things. We had this great artist in a couple years ago, Aram Han Cifuentes, who her whole artistic practice is stitching. And she just became a citizen, but she wasn't at the time, and she was stitching this huge sampler, every question on the U.S. citizenship test and every answer.
I remember this.
Yeah, and I mean, that's someone like, I mean, now she's getting all kinds of attention. She's been doing these banners and stuff, but it's really great to showcase that kind of stuff. And like, here's this artist that's like deeply engaged with this really big, complicated issue, citizenship, you know, and we can have like, and people came and they stitched with her and talked with her, and it was amazing. So yeah, in multiple ways, it feels like we're plugged into what's happening here.
The Chicago Humanities Festival, I believe, is a festival that helps Chicago kind of get out of its own way in the way that, you know, we always seem to have this second city complex. And the arts and culture scene here does as well. I mean, there's always sort of comparisons to whether it be theater, whether it be arts, whether it be even humanities. And events like yours that are happening year round help give Chicago its own identity, one that is non-comparable. Allison Cuddy, Artistic Director of Chicago Humanities Festival, in studio with me tonight. Let's take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more about arts and culture here in Chicago. Stay with us. Thanks, David. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, Allison Cuddy. She is the Artistic Director at Chicago Humanities Festival. Just announced today. Got herself a nice little Robert Feeder column. Congratulations.
Yeah, that's great.
And, you know, this is great for the festival, and you bring, like I said, a respected, highly respected arts and culture acumen. You, years at public radio here in town, both host and producer, doing a lot of arts. You're arts reporter. You know, so let's make a transition from just talking about the festival and talk about arts and culture. It's interesting because, you know, I've had a hard time with this because I've had a lot of arts people on the show. I've had a lot of people where we're talking about things that I'm not necessarily comfortable with. I don't know much about the ballet. I don't know much about the lyric opera, but I am curious about it. And I've always felt, you know, that curiosity and that lack of being intimidated by, because it's very intimidating, the entire process of following the formal and traditional when it comes to the high arts is something that's just really hard to dig into if you really don't know it. And I don't know it, but I also have the good fortune of being blind to the fact that, you know, I am ignorant.
No.
Right. I'm good at being like, I'm okay. Oh, but I mean, I guess the question I have is like, I'll always feel like people don't necessarily want to talk about arts or culture or have the discourse about it because there's no entry point. That it's a pretentious conversation. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, when it's like established, it's kind of like we were talking about like established religion, you know, and like people are kind of, lots of people are leaving that kind of religious practice and branching out on their own. And I think it is because you walk in and there's a set of rules. And if you don't know the rules, you feel a little like out, how does this work? And am I going to make a mistake and make a fool of myself? And I think sometimes in the arts, it can feel like that, right? Like if you're going into a museum or going to the opera, like, it seems like everybody else knows what they're doing. Like, I remember the first time I went to the Lyric and it was beautiful. I mean, I was sort of just, you know, getting excited about the way everything looked and wearing a fancy dress, which had nothing to do with the art, you know, it's just a spectacle.
Yeah, right.
But that's
part of it.
That's a big part of it. And like when you're, I love it, like at a program, mine or someone else's or ours or someone else's, where that buzz of people all being together, you know, where they're really excited about something happening. So I feel like, you know, you could probably do, and I think museums have done an amazing job of this, of like really trying to think about how to not be an intimidating place and like invite people in, and you have more activities going on.
Right. And, to not be exclusive. And, right. And that's sort
not
of
precious. Yeah. I mean, right. Yeah, it's a right. masterpiece, and maybe, you know, Sotheby's could get $1 gazillion for it, but it's also just something someone made at some point. Right. There's all these different ways to think about it. And so, you know, I think that it's important to try and find a way to make what you're doing feel welcoming to everybody. Like, there's a great woman at the Field Museum. I don't know if you've ever had her on, Ala Kawali. She's an anthropologist, but she did this study of culture in Chicago, right? And she interpreted in the broadest possible way and what culture really is, which is, you know, there could be a group of people gathering and singing in a church basement. It could be people having like a book club. She didn't think of it as like, you know, how many cultural organizations are and what are their budgets and how many, you know, programs do they do a year? She just thought, what are people actually doing in their communities, and tried to like get a handle on that. And it's like a really fantastic approach. And that's, I think, how we need to think about art and culture. Yeah. We were over at IDEO today. I was doing this workshop with these PhDs, and you know, that whole design thinking thing where you have to draw and you draw ideas and you do it really fast. And they were saying, you know, everyone gets really, us adults, we're like, oh, I can't draw, or someone's going to make fun of my drawing. And they're like, kids never do that. They just think, this is great. I get to draw, like, you know, I'm just going to go to town. They don't think that way. So I don't know. It would be nice to think that this is part of daily life and something we all participate in, and we may not call ourselves artists, but we all have that in us. So
there's a great line, and I've heard it a couple times, this idea that we're all artists till someone tells us we're not.
Right.
You know, I mean,
there's
that's society. We're all artists until someone says you can't do this.
Or until someone cuts the budget, because that is the one thing.
Well, that's the same concept, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it seems to me, as we try to drill down into what makes arts and culture tick, I mean, or how important it is, it seems the things I pull away from this convo is emotion, obviously the way that it makes us feel.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is this part of community, which is togetherness. And you even mentioned right at the top of the one thing about the Humanities Festival that works is that people love to be in the same room with each other, whether that could be at one of the events, watching an author talk about stuff, as you mentioned, or they're, like you just said, the church basement where people are getting together to sing. So emotion and togetherness seem to be a big sort of through lines when we talk about why culture is important.
Yeah, absolutely. It's that connectedness and expression. I mean, you know, we don't always get that license to express ourselves in different ways. And I think people are like starved for that. And they're starved for ideas. They want to actually think about serious things. Like, I don't think there's anything wrong with, I don't think that because a work of art or a piece of music is complicated or it's in a different language or anything like that means that it's not something that people would connect to. I mean, when you hear a great soprano singing, I mean, it's just, you know, it does. Yeah. Why does music make us feel emotional, whether it's like pop music or hip hop or opera? I don't know what that is, but it definitely stirs something.
I always wonder if the disconnect between people, and I get this a lot, but this concept that arts and culture isn't for everybody, that, you know, some people, you know what, I don't want to talk about that. Mm-hmm. You know, it comes from the fact that at a certain point it's devalued, that because of cutting arts programs in schools or changing the way that we value it in our education, at some point or another, it became an extracurricular activity.
Right.
And you chose sports instead.
It's like your side gig, right?
Right.
Like, it's not your main gig. Why can't it be? Like, I mean, the whole notion of progress or, you know, is that we would be liberated from work. And if we're not working, what could we do? Like, it seems like artistic production would be one of those big things, but that hasn't happened. And part of it is about cutting budgets. Like, you know, we prioritize other things, or, you know, we don't think it's worth investment. And yet I think everyone feels it's like when you think about your kids, of course you think that's part of what their education should include. You would never imagine that, you know, a child could go through school and not learn about music, right? Or how to draw. It just seems unthinkable. Yeah. And yet that kind of obviousness doesn't translate into a really strong commitment. And I mean, there's obviously a lot of people in this state and city who are super committed to the arts and culture, like the government and private citizens who put a lot of money into it. I'm not saying they don't, but it has that weird kind of, I think it is because it's, people think it's a sort of a privilege thing. It has that weird status.
I think of, as a good point about government, I think that there has been more priority put on arts and culture from leaders. And I think of, especially in the city, and I wouldn't necessarily say, I don't think of it necessarily down in state government, but I mean, at the leader, I think Mayor Emanuel goes out of his way to point out arts and culture. And I think that DCAS here, the Department of Cultural Affairs, especially with new leadership, seems to want to prioritize this, to say this is not something that, again, is extracurricular. We want this to be part of the fabric. I mean, to hear Mark Kelly talk about it, he says, I want Chicago to be known as an arts and culture city.
And it is. I mean, there was no other, when DK started and it was doing all that programming, which is all free, there was no other city in North America. I mean, I think people have like Toronto is doing that. New York just came up with its own cultural plan, which is hard to imagine. Like New York City needs a cultural plan, but they do because they're trying to figure out how to keep it alive. And because it does drive the city, it's not just the economic benefits, like that was like that big argument for arts. Well, you know, it's a great economic development tool. And fine, that's great. But it also is about that emotion and connectedness we were talking about. Like when you see, I was at a friend's and we could see down on Millennium Park the other night. The CSO was there, I think. And like the lawn was like totally packed, right? It's free. Everyone comes out. I mean, that is something that city loves and we should have that throughout the city, you know?
You know, you've covered, you know, as your job as artistic director, you've been out of it for a while, but you did for years cover arts and culture in this town. Is it an equal prospect, the idea of arts and culture? I mean, as the city says they want to be an arts and culture city, is arts and culture getting into different neighborhoods, low-income neighborhoods, places where it might be needed more than other places?
No. I mean, I think it is there. I mean, it is there on that kind of everyday level. There are artists in every community, musicians, people who gather and create stuff together, right? It's all over the city. But in terms of like funding and all of that and just access, I don't think it is. And so like for us, that's been a big priority for me, like trying to take the festival into neighborhoods. And I think it's not just us or other organizations in the city doing it. But so we're going to be in Bronzeville again this fall. We were there last year. We're going to South Shore Cultural Center. You know, we try to think, well, where could we bring the kind of programming we're doing and who are the people? We couldn't go into those neighborhoods unless there already were cultural organizations there that we could work with, right? So it part of, I think, that kind of networking is not like, oh, we're going to come save the neighborhood and bring culture. It's like we're going to go and partner with people who are doing this where there's a kind of natural connection between what they're doing, what we're doing, and it makes sense to band together.
It's an interesting thought. I mean, you're an itinerant company, so you don't have a permanent space. But I think about, you know, the museums and some of the cultural institutions that are located in Chicago, whether it be downtown or some of the neighborhoods. But this idea that they're there for Chicagoans, you do have to put some time into getting to them. Go to the Art Institute or MCA or the History Museum or whatever it might be. But they're there. You just have to, you know, and the park districts have gotten into busing camps to these different places. Mm-hmm. But changing that up and going to the neighborhoods, there's a part of me that says that's amazing and I think that's great. And you've seen a lot of institutions try to do that. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, I wonder how much of, you know, the idea that should those programs in a lot of times they're free to come to Millennium Park or what have you. It's a little bit of personal responsibility for people from the neighborhood to say, this is a shared experience. Come here together. Come out of your comfort zone. Come be a part of, to be together with other people from the city that you may not always be.
Yeah. Well, it's all our shared responsibility.
Like Taste of Chicago. That's the idea of Taste of Chicago. Anyway.
Right. Yeah. But it's not like there are people in certain neighborhoods that aren't going to it and other people who are, right? We're all like kind of spending way more time on our screens than we are going out into, you know, it's a commitment. It's a time commitment. You've got to get your kids there. You know, there's a lot involved in doing that. And so I think you need both things. But I think all of us, like ultimately, yes, that's the commitment we have to make. You have to show up and say this is important and show up for all of it, you know, a of course you're going to show up to the CSO. It's like amazing. But there's a lot of other things probably happening in your neighborhood that you could show up to.
Yeah.
And I say that for myself.
All right. So here's what we got. We got emotion,
right. Yes.
Togetherness. There was a third one you put in that was awesome. I forgot it already. And then the fourth is show up.
Show up. Just show up. Isn't that what they say? Showing up is half the battle. That's how I got through school. I'd like tell myself every day, just go.
Just
it won't be
up.
As bad as you think it will be. It's still my philosophy of life.
I was going to say, I was half expecting that quote in Feeder today. Allison said, hey, I just keep showing up.
I just keep showing up and they got to do something with me. You know, what are they going to do with me?
You're on programming for the Humanities Society. So what do you have coming up here?
Okay.
July is a big month. Usually not, but it is.
It's not normally, but we, so like I said, we do this big workshop for PhDs, humanities PhDs from all over the country are in Chicago right now. We are putting them, it's like a boot camp for them to help them think about, like, they are highly skilled.
Where do you take them?
Highly educated. I took them to the DuSable Museum and to Stony Island Arts Bank.
Nice.
You know, Edmar, the mm-hmm. unofficial mayor of Bridgeport, Ed Marzinski.
Lumpen Radio, yeah.
Lumpen Radio, he's going to give us a tour of the empire he's built there. We're going to go to his brewery. Where else are we going? We're going to IIT, to the Institute of Design to do some stuff. We were at IDEO today. So we like take them.
That's
it's really
great.
Hard for them because, you know, normally they're on their own and they don't have like a regulated schedule. And like it's every day, 8 to 5 p.m. You will enjoy Chicago, you Princeton PhD.
You will enjoy the humanities.
You will enjoy the humanities. You will know. But so on next Saturday, the 29th, we're doing the summit I was talking about on speech. So we're talking about speech on campus, speech in the arts, and speech just generally. David Cole from the ACLU, probably like one of the smartest people in the world, is going to be there with Anne-Marie Slaughter, who started the New America Foundation.
Yeah, right.
Robert Zimmer, the president of the University of Chicago, who's, you know, been somewhat controversial on their approach to speech on campus. He's going to kick it off. Academic, you know, did you hear about Middlebury College, where they brought Charles Murray, the guy who wrote The Bell Curve, and students actually physically attacked him and this professor who brought or was involved in the event.
Wow.
And so she's coming to talk. And she has a very actually interesting take on this. It's not like it's very nuanced.
I love it. I mean, the last person we had on from the Humanities Festival was Laura Kipnis, who came through with her book, and she was doing something with you guys.
Yeah.
You guys get great guests there. And then in this fall, you still have the big festival this fall, right?
The fall festival kicks off October 28th. The theme is belief in the sense of faith and belief in the sense of trust. Who do you trust? Who do you believe in? And we have like 90 programs. We've already released a few. Al Gore is coming with the sequel
great.
To An Inconvenient Truth. He's back.
That's great.
With a book, and also a film.
Yeah, that comes out soon.
That comes out soon. Reza Aslan, you know, his new book is just God, called God. He just got kicked off CNN, which is, you know, again, that polarizing debate we were talking about. You have to be really careful how you enter the fray.
That's it. All right.
Friends.
Allison Cuddy, congratulations.
Thank you,
the
Justin.
New artistic director at the Chicago Humanities Festival. You can find it out at chicagohumanitiesfestival.org. Is that what it
that's
is?
That's the website.
You can find out all the programming they do year-round. Allison, thanks for coming in and setting us straight on arts and culture. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Justin. Great to see you.
I could talk with Allison for hours. It's great. I mean, I feel like you kind of go back. We worked together, and she and I worked. She was an arts and culture reporter, and we worked on a couple of shows together. And also a host. She could do this job real easy, better than I could. But she, I just love that. I mean, we came in to talk about her job. You know, none of that was sort of pre-planned to actually talk about why arts and culture are important. But that's what you love when you have someone who is in a position of leadership to be an artistic director at one of the preeminent humanities organizations in our city, to be able to actually talk on that with confidence and to share it without it be sounding like a press release. It's pretty great. She's great. Congrats to her. Much love and respect that she's been able to continue her career in the arts and culture to be the leader of that festival. And I'm looking forward to it. The fall festival will be good. The belief stuff's good. Al Gore. We're going to talk with those guys when they come through. Inconvenient Sequel, which is really looking at the Inconvenient Truth 10 years later. I think it was 2007 that movie came out, wasn't it? It was like right around that time. I feel like it was like that, 10 years. Maybe a little older.
Let me think back to that Melissa Etheridge song. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, how about it, man? She, I don't even want to, yeah. That's a conversation I'm not sure I want to have, the Inconvenient Sequel. Because that's going to be, the movie is all about, the documentary is catching up with Al Gore as he tries to ambitiously change the course of climate change through the Paris Accord.
Dun, dun, dun. 2006.
2006, there you go. Yeah, and you know, so you know where that's going. You know, it's really, it's a film that shows how the planet has actually deteriorated since 2006. And then on top of it, it talks about how it has this, you know, this resonating, it's this curve where it's like, this is, we're going to accomplish something. We're going to get all of these developed countries to the table in Paris, and we're going to do something that changes the course. We're going to do something. Make no small plans. We're going to be ambitious leaders. We're going to take a risk and do it.
Excuse me?
Yeah. And then, I don't know, if I'm sure there's a meanwhile.
I beg your pardon. What were you talking about?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, so I don't know. It's going to be a hard conversation to have because they put some, and it's, you know, it's something that continues to be argued and debated, climate change, even though there has been a lot made that it's not the science that needs to be debated, that the planet is deteriorating and we caused it. Now it becomes, the political part is, how do we fix it, or do we change course, or do we say, you know, it's not our problem?
You know the nature of human beings, right?
Yeah.
We have to be, with our backs, literally pressed up against a wall, with the floor slowly creeping out from under us, being pulled back, and there's a big drop-off, like... Yep. You can't see the bottom of it. That's when something will happen.
Well, I hate to say it. That's
human
where
nature.
We're getting pretty close to that point when you see the devastation, destruction of places like the typhoon in the Philippines. And even in a very local way, what happened here. All right. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to play Never Have I Ever coming up here in the 10 o'clock hour, right after David's news here on The Download. So stay with us. Never, 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 never have I ever. That's what we're playing tonight here on The Download. 312-981-7200. This is a simple game. It's so much fun. Download Nation comes through every single time. We play Never Have I Ever. It's very simple. Never have I ever gone golfing. Never have I ever had a massage, professional massage. Never. Have you ever done that? Is that something that you've gotten on the table and put your head in a little round thing? That's something, yeah, right? I love this because there's so much, there's so many things in there that you're like, wow. But then there's also some great things where you're like, you know what? I agree. I'm with you on that. I've never done that. It's a good moment for us to all share together. 312-981-7200. And the best part, we'll give you a pizza if it's the best one. All right. Let's see what we got here. Mary starts us off tonight. Never have I ever had a water cooler conversation. Wow, so you mean like at work where you sit around a water cooler and you're like, what about Seinfeld? Did you see Seinfeld last night?
Does it have to be around a water cooler?
Is that what you're, yeah, is it specific? Or you just mean like shoot the breeze kind of convo at work? I feel like you have to have had that, right? Maybe in some form.
Yeah.
Because water cooler means anything at work where four or five people are around the coffee shop. Or
right,
coffee
talking
thing.
About last night's episode of the television show right. That everybody's watching.
Exactly. I guess I don't do it, but I do it here on the show. I do. Did you see the Defiant Ones?
That's it? That's
I just
your...
did it. I just did it.
I used to at the old radio station I used to work at. A lot of people would commiserate in the kitchen. There was a water cooler there, and usually they commiserated for the free food, as you know, as the way it is in radio stations. And I like, if I had to go get something, or my, you know, my lunch was in the refrigerator, I would be so mad that I'd have to go in through the whole sales staff, or, you know, eating pizza or whatever, talking about stuff that I have to like squeeze through them to get my lunch during like a 2-minute commercial break.
Yeah, right. Excuse me, pardon me. Yeah. I mean, when you're in any situation at work where you're on deadline and someone wants to water cooler with you, that's a tough situation. Yeah. And it's usually when you're running in to get something from the condiment area, yeah, or the coffee area, and someone's like, hey, I wanted to, you know, I was thinking about you because I saw that show. I can't. Except I'm one of these guys who just will stop and talk, because I'm not good at going, can't do it right now. Like, I will hedge my bet on how much time. If I have 30 seconds, I'll make it 10. Right? Skill. Mary just texted and said, I literally mean I have not stood next to a water cooler with another human being and conversed.
That's great.
That's a very specific. Oh, there you go. I always think I guess the water cooler conversation, that's the problem, is it like you have to have a water cooler at your work, but it's a lot of times that gets transferred to in front of the coffee machine.
Yeah. Is a water cooler an antiquated piece of office furniture?
I wonder.
Well, we don't have one down here.
No, we don't. No. 312-981-7200. 847 says, never have I ever had water in my basement until the 2.5 feet that was there last week. Oof. That's a bummer. I'm with you. I've never had water. That's not true. I totally take that back. Living in Wonder Lake, and it was rarely ever because of a flood. It was because our washing machine was a piece of garbage. One of those things where my dad just would fix it, but it never was fixed. And then I'll never forget this moment, because downstairs in our basement was the washer and dryer, right? And once in a while, the washer would overflow or just have a problem with sump pump and it would flood the basement. But that's also where our Nintendo was. And so you get into a game of Zelda or maybe an RBI baseball or something like that, right? Me and my brother, or Madden, playing something, you know, when I get to the Sega. And I remember one time my mom came down, she was doing the laundry, she came down past us and she walked right into like a splash of water that was all pooled around our chairs, but nobody saw it because we were playing Nintendo.
I didn't even notice that it was, and you're going to be underwater,
yeah,
in an hour.
She was so mad, and she just looked, she goes, could you be any more oblivious? And that's what she said, and it stuck with me forever. I was like, oh God, it was so harsh. I'll never be oblivious in my life again. Thanks, Mom, for the lesson. Ooh, level 3. Moved on. 847 says, I've never have I ever seen or read anything Harry Potter. Huh. You know, I'd feel the same way, but I have a 9-year-old now, and I we've talked about it on the show. Just recently, I dug in and watched all 38 movies or whatever, how many movies there are, and now he's reading all the books, so it's all over our house. But so I don't think it's that far-fetched to have avoided in your life the Harry Potter series, because and we've had this conversation before. I mean, it was very specific to a specific generation. If you were in seventh grade in the late 90s, oh man, if you avoided it at that point, I don't know how you could, right? Everybody was into it, and from that point on. But you know, for me in the late 90s, I'm in my 20s. I don't care about Harry Potter. And maybe I saw the first movie and I'm like, meh, it's no Lord of the Rings. Right? That's how everybody reacted. Eh, it's a flying owl. I don't get it. So they go to school. They're whimsical. They're magicians. Oh, wizards. Got it. So no burning eye of fire. No hobbits. No ghosts on horses. Nah, this is not for me.
I feel like when you get into something that is so big like Harry Potter, but in that you have no idea what people are talking about, I try to go out of my way, even though I haven't seen Harry Potter, to at least kind of be familiar with a little bit of the jargon.
Yeah, it's like Game of Thrones. I don't watch Game of Thrones. Don't watch it. I tried a couple times, but I understand what's happening. I get it. There are some zombies that are going to kill everybody.
Flying
and
dragons.
And there's a dragon, right? And there's boobs. I get it. Those are three things of Game of Thrones, right? And surprises. And medieval surprises.
Yeah.
I get it. I think I nailed it, right? Like, if I were in the test market, they're like, hi, thank you for coming to this test, what do you call it? Like, whatever those are called. Where you,
yeah.
I just wanted to say, do you watch the show Game of Thrones, and what do you think? What's the takeaway? Well, dragons, zombies, boobs, and you got it.
Congratulations, you hit it on the head.
312-981-7200. Never have I ever done rock, paper, scissors. You could do that right now. Like, I think the idea is that, like, when I say never have I gone golfing, I have to go golf. You could do rock, paper, scissors right now, unless you have nobody in the room with you. You could figure it out. That would be one off the bucket list, like, boom.
Yeah. Knock that out.
Knock it out.
Yeah.
That's low on the list. What are you doing? I'll do it with you right now.
Take charge.
Ready? One, two, three. Nope. One, two, three. Oh, wow, two ties. One, two, three. Ah, scissors beats paper. You're out. See? You did it. 815 gives us one that we get every time. Never have I ever driven a stick shift. Every time we do this, someone says that. And I feel as if that's something, that's a rite's path. My dad taught me on sticks.
Really?
Yeah, so I could drive it. Once in a while. My dad, because they're cheaper cars. When I became an adult, I realized what my dad was doing. They're cheaper. And so he's, even to this day, he's still got the stick shift.
Does he really?
Yeah, and I'll be like, why do you have a stick shift? What's the matter with you? And he's like, no, it's a good car.
He likes the feeling of driving. Yeah.
It's $2,000 cheaper.
Yeah.
You know, because, like, you don't have to do the automatic. That's all that is.
It's not driving when you just you're sitting behind the car with a wheel.
Absolutely not. Yeah. It's a cheaper car.
I see a lot of these, you get these things were better than in the 80s memes, on Facebook, did you ever have some Nestle Quick, things like that. And I see, I just saw yesterday one that said, if you could always stop texting and driving if you had a stick
shift.
They're
stealing that from me. They memed that off of me. I was complaining about that on this show within a month ago. Last time we did Never Have I Ever, I think I brought it up. These memesters, they steal from Kaufman all the time. No, I agree. I think that it could solve the world's problem of texting and driving if we just got rid of automatics and force people to stick shift again, because you wouldn't be able to go, except what we came up with afterwards, we would do it anyway. It'd just be more dangerous.
Yeah, there's some. Yeah,
something
you figure
would happen,
out.
312-981-7200. They're coming in fast and furious tonight. I love it. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We're playing Never Have I Ever. Stay with us. Playing Never Have I Ever, 312-981-7200. We got a lot of great stuff coming in. Oh, I love it. 773. Never have I ever dyed my hair or had a manicure. I'm low maintenance. Oh, okay. I don't know I'm bald. I don't know anything about dyeing hair.
I feel sorry for them never having had a manicure or a pedicure.
Yeah, that's your jam?
Occasionally, I'll get a pedicure, but I feel sorry for anyone who's never had the experience. It is so relaxing.
The pedicure makes you feel like a celebrity, no doubt. The manicure makes you feel, I get a little skittish with that. That's just too, it's too close.
Yeah, once in a while, you know.
But yeah, dyeing your hair, I don't know what goes in. I mean, I guess you go to the salon for dyeing your hair. Are you talking about like in the bathroom where you're like trying to go pink or blonde or something like that?
Well, like you, I have this lack of follicle.
Yeah.
So, dyeing the hair is just kind of, not all happening.
Right. 847 says, never have I ever broken a bone or been punched in the face.
They're lucky.
I got punched in the face once when I was a kid.
So did
From
I.
From a fight?
Yeah. I'll never forget. I think I mentioned this one time. I was a...
Did you not see it coming either?
Yeah, I didn't see it coming. Yeah.
I didn't either.
Yeah. Two times. One, it's probably more than two the more I get into it. One time I was at Top Gun, And before Top Gun began in the theater, I was macking on a couple of, you know, hotties, 13-year-old hotties.
Yeah, of course.
And two of the guys who were just in the theater just didn't think my bits were funny. That was it. No, we had no interaction, anything. And then we were walking out of the theater an hour and a half after the movie. This is before the movie. I was kind of like standing up and goofing around with these kids, these girls. They were like, "You funny?" I'm like, "Yeah, well." And I got a tap on my shoulder. I turned around. I got punched in the face.
Really?
Yeah.
Cheap shot.
Total cheap shot.
Well, count your blessings. Back in the day, that's the worst it would be.
That's right.
Nowadays, know, it's right. Like, oh, let's just shoot them right in the theater.
That's exactly it. And the worst part was that, and I'll never forget this. Like, so I got hit. I got dazed, and it caused a little bit of a melee. And the usher, the guy who owned the theater, the McHenry Theater, is like, hey, and he goes, "Guys, shake on it." I'm like, "What did I? What did I have to shake on it? This was a cold cock."
Yeah.
You know, what do I do? She should be. I didn't fight. I didn't do
be
anything.
Apologizing.
I'm the one who has to shake this guy's hand. And the other one was a.
This was in public, and other people are around.
Yeah, and then the next one was one I've talked about as well. Very embarrassing moment where I was punched by. I can't remember her name, but Autumn maybe April. Anyway, I got sucker punched in gym class by a senior girl. I was a sophomore.
Ouch.
It was not a good moment for my social status in school, I'll tell you that.
I have to ask a question. What did you do?
Trash talking on the softball diamond, which I'm good at. But the so get this real quick because I want to get back to the texters. But she hit a little ground ball to the pitcher, right? Throws to first. The first baseman kind of dropped it maybe, or the ball got away, but she didn't run. And so the guy stepped on first base and she was out. And I don't know, I was just like channeling all the little league coaches. I kind of walked by. I go, "This is why you run every time." Like, I said that to like the cool burnout girl who didn't want to be in gym class. "That's why you run every time." And she threw the F-bomb at me.
Yeah.
And it was too close to Coach Sonny, who was like, "Amber, got to take a lap." So they made her take a lap. And she was furious at me. And I'm like, so then she comes back, right? She got more furious on the lap. So she comes back and she goes right up to me. And she's like, "You F-bomb, right? Amber."
More laps.
Two more laps. Yeah. So she has to do three laps around the gym time.
Right.
And so on the way back into the thing, nothing else happened. There was no more argument. I was just like, "Oh, man." And we're walking in and she was, you know, she was tough. She was a tough burnout senior. And she needed, you know, what am I going to do? I'm a sophomore kid. I'm not going to get in a fight with a girl.
Mm-hmm.
She comes up behind me and she's like, hey. She's like being cool and everyone's watching. Like, and then the jock guys are like, kick his ass. And then she punched me in the face.
And then you're there and you can't really do anything.
You can't really do anything. You just kind of like just shake it off. And then I remember this one guy. I don't even remember his name. But I just remember in the locker room afterwards being like, "I would have dropped her." And you're like, right. Good.
A tough guy.
You really nailed it right there. So those are my two times. I feel like, again, it's a night of therapy here on the download. Get those out of the system. 847 says, "Never have I ever had a speeding ticket I didn't deserve." That's good. That's a very honest text. You've gotten speeding tickets before that you deserved, but you've never ever have got one that you didn't. Sounds fair.
Do they just give out tickets willy-nilly?
I guess people would say, I was only going 50.
Yeah, well, only going two over or whatever.
Like,
or
I guess that's what we're talking about. 630 says, "Never have I ever stopped looking at and loving the bra section of the Sears catalog." Jerry in Aurora. Jerry, that's hilarious.
Oh, it's priceless.
I mean, what are you looking for there? There's not much to see.
Do they still have a Sears catalog?
I
don't think that exists.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, first, number one, there's a lot not going on with that text. One, with Sears catalog.
Unless he's using old ones, like, you know, from the swap meet. They probably have them at the Wolf's Flea Market. You can get old Sears catalogs.
Wow. Yeah, and the second is like, he's like, "Oh, that's great support."
Ba-dum-bum.
Oh, look at the support on that one. Look at the straps on that shoulder. All right. 217 says, never have I ever had satellite cable or dish TV. Amish TV at our house. So that just mean 2579 kind of thing? That's what Chicago means when you say Amish TV, right?
Yeah.
2579?
32.
Yeah, 2579. Then they turn it to 12.
when I'm at home and my wife will ask me, like, what channel something's on, I'll say 32, and she, like, she gets so angry. She's like, all right, old man, 32.
32. It's so true. 2579 32. That's a Chicago. That's Chicago TV. That should be a question when we put together a quiz. We've got a new segment we're going to be coming up with this fall where it's like Chicago quiz. 2579 32. You got to say it like that, or otherwise that's not Chicago TV. All right, 312-981-7200. All right, I got a lot of them still to go. We got tons tonight, so add yours to the mix. These are great tonight. We will take a break and an update on tonight's news. Second half of Never Have I Ever coming up here. Stay with us. Playing Never Have I Ever tonight here on the download, 312-981-7200. We're playing for pizza. I feel like we're getting somewhere. We have some great, great ones already. And the ones coming up here, there's one coming up here that I think is going to be the winner. It's good. All right, but first let's get to all of them here. 847 says, never have I ever smoked a cigarette. That's good for you. And because of that, you know, the government can't get your tax money.
You don't know what you're missing. They're delicious.
You a smoker?
No.
All right. Let's see what else. Wow. 262 says, never have I ever been on a jury to convict someone for murder or witness an execution. That one may be, that I guess is a winner in the sense that there's probably a lot of nevers. A lot of people would relate to that saying, yeah, and I've never witnessed an execution either.
I've never been on a jury.
At all?
No,
me neither.
I've been called a couple of times.
I've been called too, but I never stick. They don't like me. Too chatty.
Go in there, yeah.
I turn into talk
scene.
Show host.
Yeah.
They're like, yeah, what about you? I'm like, well, let's talk about you for a second. We're here at the jury tonight. It's jury selection here. I'm Justin Kaufman. With me, the lawyer who's asking me questions. Why don't we start with you? Where are you from? What is your strategy when you're trying to pick a jury selection? Number one can go. Thank you. Goodbye. No, that's ridiculous. That's not true. Okay. All right. Ready for this one? All right. Here's the ones that I have. Never have I ever had a craft beer, 708 says. I quit drinking 10 years ago before the craft beer boom happened.
Oh, yeah.
That's an interesting one, right? I'm going to put that one as a finalist.
Would you consider Sam Adams Boston Lager?
Oh yeah, right. Or like a,
you know, that was probably the original, or even like the Goose Island.
Yeah, right. Goose Island maybe not, but I would think like do you consider Red Dog craft beer, like a Berghoff, where you're like, oh nice. Or what's the one that Killian's Red,
Killian's Irish Red? Yeah,
is that a craft? Early craft? All right. Here's my winner for tonight so far. Beat this one. Ready? 815. I am 45 years old and never have I ever held a baby.
Hmm.
Hey, right?
Yeah.
That's an early winner right there. That's my front runner.
I wonder, I'm friends with a person who is kind of just afraid, you know, likes kids, but afraid of holding babies. Afraid, you know, just afraid that they're going to drop, drop somebody else's kid, you
right.
know, they're squirming out of your hands.
Right.
So is it just, I wonder if it's just you've never been around a baby to hold,
it's
or
like
you have, and you
just
refuse to go near them.
Yeah. There's a lot of questions. That's what makes it good because it goes against, I mean, 45 years old, so you don't have your own kids. But it goes against that 45, at some point or another, a baby must have been offered on your lap.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to hold this? And you had
to
say,
no, baby.
You gotta hold the baby. So I like that one. That's good. 217 says, never have I ever paid a cable bill. Had no TV in college or after. Bragger. And I'm about to retire.
Oh, wow.
That's great. Don't start now. Because you know what they'll do? They go, oh, first time customer. It's $10 for the first 90 days, and then it's $250, and you can't get out of it.
There's a, and I remember there's a, an episode of, I want to say it's Friends, where they go into a house, and or maybe it was King of Queens, I don't know, one of those shows, they go into a house and they can't find the TV. And it was either Joey or Doug Heffernan. They're like, you know, where's the TV? And they're like, you know, we don't have a TV. And Joey or Doug Heffernan said, then he's like, what do you point the furniture at?
Uh, 630 says, never have I ever been overseas, and I'm 46 years old. All right. That's okay, though.
Can I kick one in?
Yeah, there we go.
For the young, someone who would be really young, mm-hmm. never have I ever had to get up to change the channel on the television set.
Interesting. Right. Actually, on the set. I don't even think you could do that anymore.
No, they don't even, yeah, you can. Some models still do have that function.
Well, I mean, I remember in my day, the cable spin, like the little dial that you, mm-hmm. like that was a cable thing, and you could spin that thing, because I remember being over at Richie's house, and Richie had the Playboy channel. And so there'd be a bunch of guys maybe watching the Playboy channel, and then you'd hear the driveway in the garage because his mom was coming home, and he'd reach up when he'd hear the door, and he'd flip that thing to wherever it lands. We'd be watching the Weather Channel.
Oh, I've never seen that as a cable function before.
Yeah, no, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
Like the, it was
yeah.
like a dial yeah. like you put
on
top
the set?
Of it. Well, it's not on the set. Oh. It's like the cable. It's not a cable. It was kind of before cable boxes, mm-hmm. right? It was like a little dial, spin dial that you could like, it had like very small numbers on it. Yeah. Oh, hey guys, what are you guys doing? Oh, I'm just watching the
Weather Channel.
Was it the real Playboy Channel?
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, I mean it was for. I mean, I feel terrible for this generation. This generation, the options in that regard are very graphic. In our generation, it was softcore, late night Cinemax, which was not as hardcore as the offerings today. But the point being, it was something that was half-naked people in it.
Yeah, because like when you first got cable, I remember you would tune into late-night HBO,
yeah.
even though your parents
yeah.
didn't get HBO.
Yeah.
And you'd watch a scrambled television in hopes that a boob would flash by. That you might see a boob.
Yes. See, he had
I think I saw a boob.
He had the full ride. He had the late night HBO, so we could watch the late night HBO and like have like the weird movie that you're just like, I think there will be a boob at some point. stay focused, people. And then he'd get up there and flip it to whatever.
Around.
Oh, hey, Mom. You guys, why are you guys watching Spanish Channel?
Well, I'm just trying to pick up a new language.
All right. All right, here we go. Jerry's got, never have I purposely listened to a complete country song or rap song. Okay. At home, in the car, I flipped the station. I like rock, jazz, blues, classical, but those two hated genres. The lyrics and music all sound so similar. I don't feel challenged or informed or surprised. I guess, but you're limiting yourself because that's so generic. I don't like country music per se, but there's stuff that I come across. I'm like, it's interesting. I like rap music. There's stuff that I don't. I mean, I don't know how you can take one genre and take it out of play.
Kind of along the same lines of Harry Potter, or not knowing something about that, something that is, you know, part of the zeitgeist, the cultural zeitgeist, is that I don't really listen to contemporary radio that much anymore. So I don't, when I see on Spotify or whatever, all these like great songs like that are hits, I'm like, I don't even know who these people are, you know, who. So I try to make it a point to like, all right, I'm going to listen to a song to see, I know at least if it comes up culturally in an article, I know who these people, you know, these people are.
It's interesting because it's a relatable thing for my son who's 9 years old. He really gets into pop music. He's attracted to it. He's related to it. And he only gets it in the car.
Yeah.
So we'll listen to the Kiss FMs, things like that, when we're in the car together. And then it's transferred to the pop channel on Apple Music, which plays the same stuff. So now when I get in the car, I just plug in the phone, you know, because I still have a tape. I can plug the tape in and then have the cord go into my phone. You know, like that's how old my car is right now. I just realized that, like, I'm on the last. Like, when I went to the Honda dealership and I was waiting for the car to be serviced, I was talking to one of the sales guy, and I'm like, oh, no, I got a 2005 Honda CR-V or whatever. And he goes, what? He goes, the one with the cassette player? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, that's a good one, man. That's a class. Like he called it out, that specific car. And I'm like,
really?
He was like, because it's the last one they made with the cassette player.
Oh, so this is
like a swap meet.
Yeah,
bin.
Yeah. You got a good item on
and
your hands.
And then he said it's worth nothing.
Oh.
So. But I was like, yeah, I've had a little pride. They still have a cassette player in my car. Never have I ever used it, except for the Apple adapter goes in there. But all right, let's keep going here. All right. Never have I ever played a nose flute without hyperventilating from laughing too hard. What's a nose flute? Like, I feel like that's a cocaine reference, but I don't think it is.
I don't know what that means.
Yeah. 630 says, why doesn't Mueller investigate Russia and the Clintons? Nope, sorry. That's something entirely different.
Wrong.
That's not a different show.
Wrong station.
847, almost 64, grew up as a wild child of the 60s, had a lot of fun, but never ever smoked a cigarette or pot. Hated the smoking thing. There you go. 847 says, never have I ever had Starbucks. Wow. Not even try like to get.
How is that possible?
I mean,
how
I guess you if you live it? In an area that doesn't have a Starbucks or has only one and it's you know, like coffee's not a thing, you don't drink it. I could see that. In Chicago, it's hard to avoid because they I mean, literally, I am staring at one right now.
Mm-hmm.
Like right out the window here on Michigan Avenue, there's a Starbucks. And that's one. And if I could had a little mirror and I was playing like a little pew, 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 pew.
Yeah.
I would be able to bounce a rock off of that Starbucks and hit the other Starbucks across the street.
I'm looking at a Starbucks. We're looking in different directions. I'm also seeing a Starbucks. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they take away the intimidation factor because there's so many of them. You know, like, all right, I'll walk in there. Although, I did tell the story that I went into Starbucks and they had like a iced coconut. And I was like, ooh, that looks good. Like, it was like on the outside. I'm like, I'm going to try this. A frappa waka waka, you know? And I walked in there and I got up there and I got confused. Like, right away, I was like, which one? Just give me a large coffee. That's what I said. Like, because then I'm cool. I've subverted their system by not using their language. Just large coffee. Put some cream in it. Thank you. God, Starbucks.
You know the sign of the end of the universe, don't you?
What?
I think it was a Lewis Black line. When you turn around one day and realize that there's a Starbucks that's opened inside another
that's
Starbucks.
That's going to happen, man. That's on its way. That's a funny bit that he does, and it's on his way to being reality. All right, 312-981-7200. We'll take our last break. We'll come back. We'll finish up with Never Have I Ever, give away a pizza, and then we'll make way for Patty Vasquez coming up at 11. Stay with us. Playing Never Have I Ever here on the download, 312-981-7200. Justin Kaufman here. All right, we got some good stuff. 608 says, Google red plastic nose flute. They're legit. Everyone at GN should have one. Okay, good. Never have I ever watched an episode of Breaking Bad, Game of Thrones, Walking Dead, Survivor, Dancing with the Stars, Amazing Race, Bachelor, Bachelorette, and yet here I am. I'm with you on a couple of those. Never have I ever watched Breaking Bad. Isn't that crazy? Walking Dead, never seen it. Dancing with the Stars, never seen it. Amazing Race, never seen it. And yet here I am. 219, little kismet. We're on the same page. I've only seen like a handful of episodes of Game of Thrones and Survivor and Bachelor. None of those shows appeal to me. But I should watch them. But whenever I have a chance, like a free moment, it's in a weird time of the day. Like it's always in the mid-morning. So I just watch like First Take on ESPN. It's just in the background. And I'm like, why did I choose this dreck? This is what the Cowboys need to do. And you're like, oh, God, enough of the Cowboys. It's always, whenever I tune into ESPN, they're talking about the Cowboys.
Yes.
So annoying. You're like, all right, I know they're popular, but Is there anything else in sports to talk about than the Cowboys?
I know. I was, yeah, it's like, as I watch a lot of ESPN in the morning too, and I'm, it's like, yeah, when the Yankees and the Red Sox are playing.
Oh, gosh.
You know, it was during Wimbledon, and I know a lot of people don't like tennis, but I was like, I watched the whole show for, like, it was an hour, and they had not one thing about
it. It's all about Cowboys camp. And then yesterday they had a thing where it was a feel-good story where Dak Prescott brought a sick kid to Cowboys camp. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, enough of the Cowboys. I get it. Can't that kid go to see the Broncos or something different? It's always got to be the Cowboys.
Let's talk to the new coach of the Tennessee Volunteers for some reason. You know, they're talking about college football. I know it's coming up, and it's exciting.
Oh, gosh, it is coming up. 630, never have I had Starbucks either. Don't drink coffee. I do drive through the McDonald's for Diet Coke every day, though. Wow. I don't think that's a good idea. The drive through every day for Diet Coke.
Mm-mm.
But I'm no one to preach, because Pete and I get an iced coffee for 99 cents every day at 3 o'clock. So. 630 says, never have I ever pooped at work. Okay. I only read that one because we're in the twilight, FCC twilight here at 10:53. 779 says, I'm 76 years old and I've never been to Navy Pier. Hey, lucky you. I worked there for 20 years. I could tell you, you know what? I'll take you down there. I'm going to show you what you've been missing. And you'll, after about 10 minutes, you go, this is it? Really? This is what happened? Oh. Never have I ever had a TV in my bedroom. 219 says, I don't have a TV in my bedroom. Yeah. 773 says, never have I ever been the little spoon. What is that? Is that sexual? Did I miss something there? I probably did. I like this one. 847 says, never have I ever had a threesome phone conversation. The joke is three-way, right? Wasn't it a three-way conversation? What was it when you used to do the phone? Wasn't it called a three-way? Or what would they call it when it was like you could get everybody on?
A three-way, I think, yeah.
Yeah, so they messed up that joke. It shouldn't have been a threesome phone conversation. It should be a three-way phone conversation, right?
Yeah, my buddy Mike Ford. He was the first guy in the neighborhood to get the three-way.
Three-way
so
calling,
me,
right?
Mike Ford, Pat Reedy, make our plan. Like, let me get Pat Reedy on the phone.
That's great.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's awesome. Those are great kid names, by the way. Mike Ford and Pat Reedy. Pete Zimmerman. I love it. So, like, were you guys all on the same Little League team?
Pat Reedy was actually the first pitcher that I faced in Little League. My first three at-bats struck me out three times in a row.
That's not cool.
I believe looking all three times.
Come on, Reedy.
Yeah, he was a good athlete.
Yeah. 708 says, never have I ever ate a Big Mac, even though I worked at McDonald's for 15 years. What? Aren't you like, don't you have to do that by like work rules? Wow. That's a weird one.
There's a lot. They have a lot of other burger offerings that you've probably taken part in.
Yeah.
Put your hand in the fries. Walk by. Take one as you walk by.
That's the game we should play with this caller. We should be like, what have you done? Never have I ever put your hands in the fryer? Yes, I've done that. Okay. Never have I ever spit on a hamburger? Yes, I've done that. Never had a Big Mac? No, never had a Big Mac. Never messed with the ingredients of a shamrock shake. All right, that's going to do it. Never have I ever. Great. You guys are so fun. This is so fun, you guys. Thanks so much for playing along tonight. And we'll do this. I say this every week. I'm like, we're going to do more of this, and then we don't do it for a couple weeks. But I always enjoy doing it, and it's fun to play along and hear your never have I evers. All right, so the winner tonight's going to get a Lou Malnati's pizza. Find Lou Malnati's at any of their 40 locations, loumalnati's.com. The winner, of course, as I mentioned already, I think it's got to be the winner, right? The 815. I'm 45, and never have I ever held a baby. That is the winner tonight. We'll get your stuff. We'll send you out a gift certificate, a Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Appreciate you playing. Everybody playing tonight. Tonight was actually a tough one, and I almost changed my mind at the end just on the I never have I ever had a Big Mac and I worked at McDonald's for 15 years. A Filet-O-Fish guy? What is that? All right. Thank you so much for playing tonight. Coming up, Patty Vasquez here. Stay with us. That's going to do it tonight in a download. Patty Vasquez up next. Okay, so we're out tomorrow. Pete and I are out. Amy's in. Amy Goose in. And then I think they're splitting it, right, Esmeralda?
Yep, me and John Hanson, 9 to 11.
Awesome. What's on the show tomorrow? This is a crosstalk.
We're actually going to have on some of the people who run The Plant, which is in back of the Yards neighborhood,
okay,
I believe
great.
It is.
Okay, great, yeah.
Have you ever heard of The Plant?
I have. I don't know much about it, though.
It's this cool place where they're trying to do like a closed loop thing where, you know, everything, waste and all that gets recycled in one form or another. So they're having a fest down there on the 29th that weekend. So we're going to talk to them about
that. All right. 9 to 11 tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So Amy's 7 to 9. You guys are 9 to 11. We'll be back on Monday night where the new owner of the Chicago Sun-Times, Edwin Eisendrath, will sit down with me at the big table. We'll talk about the future of the paper. It's coming up on Monday. So have a great weekend, even though it's Thursday.